Okay, so the book, Brian, for finding the quote, is called Counterblasting Canada. It came out in 2016. Copyright Gregory Betts. He's the guy that I'm commenting on. And Paul Hjartarson and Christine Smitka. And basically it's about the relationship, actually on the inside page, Counterblasting Canada, Marsha McLuhan in one spiral, but then the next spiral says Wyndham Lewis, and then the third spiral says Wilfred Watson and Sheila Watson. So it's basically about what McLuhan, Watson, the two Watsons did with Lewis. You know, counterblast, this 1969 book, replaying the title from 54, where McLuhan says he's not anti Lewis's 1914 blast journal that put Lewis on the map. He is reverberating it. It's a blast. Yeah, there it is. It's a blast to reverberate it, to echo it, to complement what Lewis did and update Lewis. So here's McLuhan. He's an expert on Lewis, and he knows there's a problem with Lewis, so he's going to update, redo Lewis, just like I saw there was a problem with McLuhan, so I updated and redid McLuhan differently. So in this book, you go to, in my index here, we go to page, I've got about 12 pages. So we're going to go to page 24. And it turns out, well, I knew this, Gregory Betts refers to the quote. But looking at the book again, there's a second essay, which I hadn't noticed before because I haven't read much of the book. The second guy deals with the quote. It's called... the guy is called... Adam Welch. He works as a curator at the Ottawa Museum. You know, he's part of the art establishment. He has a big job at... I'll just read the back what it says about him. Adam Welch is an associate curator, Canadian art at the National Gallery of Canada. He is currently working toward his doctorate in art history at the University of Toronto with a dissertation titled Borderline Research, then subtitled Art Between Canada and the United States, 65 to 75. That actually could be a dissertation on the quote, Brian. So we should find out what he's done, because this is 9 years ago when the book comes up. No, did I say 2016? Yeah, 8 years ago. Sounds like he's not an old guy. If he's working on his doctorate, he's a young guy, and he's an associate curator. He has a job at Canadian Art. Other people in the book are Leon Surrett. He's an interesting story. Paul Teason, another interesting story. Elaine Lamberti and Gregory Betts. Gregory Betts is the Chancellor's Chair for Research Excellence at Brock University. Yeah, a nowhere place. Where he is also... Now, at nowhere places, you get the creative stuff. That's what Captain Beefheart and Zappa said when they were kids, 20 years old, looking about whether to go to college or not. They said, you go to the obscure colleges, the ignored colleges. That's where the real thinkers are. They're not at Yale and those bullshit places. Gregory Betts is a director of the Center for Canadian Studies and associate professor at the Department of English Language and Literature. He is the author of, quote, Avant-Garde Canadian Literature, The Early Manifestations. That's 2013. And then he did a book on the avant-garde in Vancouver. And he's editor of 6 critical editions of experimental Canadian literature and currently serves as the curator of the bpnickel.ca digital archive. So he specializes in the obsolete avant-garde of B.P. Nickel and those guys in Canadian history that Cavell started off talking about in his first book. So... let's go to Gregory Betts, page 24. Yes. So he says, he does a bit about McLuhan, introduces McLuhan and what he was doing as an art critic or as an avant-garde model of how to be a teacher, how he was fawned over by the avant-garde in New York City, and his New York life. John Cage and those guys. Then he says, the intellectual thug avant-garde model. So McLuhan says in 51 he's an intellectual thug. That's sort of a replay of Lewis and those guys, the 1920s modernist avant-garde artist. The intellectual thug avant-garde model almost entirely disappeared as McLuhan's career advanced and new opportunities in the classroom developed. So that is what Clinton read, the avant-garde thug model in the 40s. In the 50s, McLuhan drops that. Right, Clinton? And he's a different person. I think right. That's what Betts is saying. The thug avant-garde model almost entirely disappears as McLuhan's career advanced and new opportunities in the classroom developed. Well, TV showed up. His conception of McLuhan's conception of cultural perspective and the function of the counter-environments entirely shaped his evaluation of art. His conception of cultural perspective and the artist as anti-environment entirely shape his evaluation of art. Now here it is. In his 1967 Marv Fleet lecture at the University of Toronto. Now back in 77, I went to CBC and listened to these lectures. They were a big deal. They're a special, prestigious lecture. McLuhan is king in 67, so the University of Toronto had to give him the Marv Fleet lecture. And it's a very good lecture. Something that could be analyzed and read. There's important statements in there that are not known. So Betts went and listened to it. So he says, in his 1967 Marv Fleet lecture at the University of Toronto, McLuhan extended the cultural vantage provoked by avant-garde eruptions to the cultural vantage created by Canada. So this general cultural vantage in studying Joyce, Lewis, the modernists, and filmmakers, and all kinds of multimedia artists, of the modernists and beginning postmodernists. That is what McLuhan did understanding media on. But here he is saying, amazingly, there's something about Canada. So what he said, this is the part quoted, what all of us do, only the artist makes visible. The ordinary procedures and environmental patterns of a society don't become visible until the artist creates this counter-environment of art objects. This is a frontier problem that relates to Canada's position as a frontier country, giving Canada a kind of world art role in making visible the vast man-made American environment that's becoming a world environment. So McLuhan continues and says, I don't know whether that makes much sense at first, but as the United States becomes a world environment, some means is needed to make it visible and capable of appraisal and appreciation and criticism that only the artist can do. And Canada is essentially in this artistic role. End of quote. So Betts says, while McLuhan's comments are best characterized as probes more suited for further consideration, the fact that he used part of his lecture to even consider the possibility of extending the avant-garde function to an entire nation signals his distance from the artist as hero model of the historical avant-garde. You know, the thug model, artist as hero, that's all dumped. McLuhan is saying the art world has nothing to do with what's the problem. The problem is you got media environments, they're the art forms, and the only environment would have to be a fucking nation, a collective environment. So he says the fact that he used part of his lecture to even consider the possibility of extending the avant-garde function to an entire nation signals his distance from the artist's hero model of the historical avant-garde. In its place, art, in brackets, and Canada, is valued for what it reveals and makes open to criticism, colon, for shifting perceptions and provoking debate and evaluation. That's the role of art. The optimal function of art is indistinguishable from the optimal function of the classroom in the creation of counter-environments. So McLuhan was starting to say in the 60s that to be an artist, anybody is an artist, no matter what they do. They're all obsolete and anti-environments. So being a teacher, he said, can be a role player, can get a role and turn the art, the teaching world into a counter-environment. So that's how this guy is taking this Kenda's nation. The first level, the optimal function of art is indistinguishable from the optimal function of the classroom in the creation of counter environments. Now, a lot of artists who became artists, like Carolee Schneeman and Michael Snow and everybody you ever heard of who propped up the university art industry, they didn't think any fucking art was going on in the classroom. They left the classroom, like William Irwin Thompson, and went out there and tried to make it somehow as business people or as grant getters, okay? The whole grant thing. And that's a big factor about Canada that Trudeau brings in. It's like the best grant giver of any country in the world, and artists in other countries can't believe what artists can get away with on the grant level and be artists and be funded by the government. But as Zappa said, what the fuck are you doing being funded by the government? You're not an anti-environment. You can't be an anti-environment if you do the Gutenberg arts. McLuhan came up with the only real anti-environment, Canada, a fucking corporate collection media environment led by Pierre Trudeau, and that whole image and icon was an anti-environment to the American mixed corporate media or the global theater or media as art forms. This is a really incredible point in art history, that to name a fucking country as the top artist of the day, Brian, you got to be impressed with that.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I've just...
Yeah, I felt like you could have gone a couple of... That is a quote that needs to be dealt with or else don't.
Okay, you're fading out a bit, but Brian...
I agree with the...
Okay, here's what I want to ask you. I've talked about this a little bit here and there. Did you ever hear me do it before? Is this all new to you?
I think I may have heard you say it before. I'm not sure if I heard this that full quote. I don't know. It sounds like...
Yeah, you wouldn't have known about the Marfleet lecture and where it came from. You know, you wouldn't know this. So that's the first quote. That's 24 and 25. Now, I'll just fill you some more. What'd you say, Clinton? You said something, Clinton.
Sorry. As you were.
You just blurted out. Have you heard this idea before, Clinton, in your reading?
Specifically Canada? No. Okay. I mean, it's a very nice... concentrated summary of the general point of Canada as anti-environment, Canada as, I guess it's kind of inherent in the idea of the borderline case, but yeah, no, it's spelling it out. No, this is very good. Thank you, Bob.
Right.
Yeah, this borderline case.
But yeah, it's I'm used to hearing him say that, Canada's lucky.
Yeah.
Maybe this could be to our advantage.
Yep.
That we are. I'm not sure if I've heard specifically the framing of like an artistic.
No. What people? It's in Counterblast 69. Canada is in a good position to explain America to the world because it's the most involved, the most swamped by American media than the rest of the world was going to eventually get to. But Canada was the leading victim, the first victim of the American expansion of the 1670s. And he points that out in Counterblast. But in the art world, to call Canada an artist, the nation. Now, there was charisma for Canadians in the 60s. Among the baby boomers, the myth was that Americans are assholes. Europeans would encounter American students, Canadian students. American students were fucking assholes, selfish bullshit people. Canadians were wonderful. Canadians had a high profile of acceptability in Europe for whatever advantage you get as you're hitchhiking around or, crashing here and there. The Americans were avoided. That was the myth, the pattern, the feeling, the truth of the 1670s. So Canada was seen as an anti-environment to America, coming from North America, or a human chemical body, nice people, They're fucking somebody you can talk to. They're not egomaniacs. So Carolyn and I witness a lot of this as we travel around in the Seat Council of 10. But the other thing is that Trudeau was quite admired around the world, sort of like the way Clinton was in the 90s. He was considered a different kind of politician, not an American guy. And McLuhan wrote an article in New York Review of Books or something in right around when Trudeau got in 68 that he said a politician like Trudeau, whose his face looks like a Mohawk, an Indian, and he's French-Canadian, he's counter-English Canada and all that, he could not be a president of the United States. Because the United States is in the hot spot on the efficient causality level. It's in the center of all the fucking problems that are happening. They're making the 60s tumultuous. And you can't have a radical in the White House. You had to have a fucking assassin like LBJ or Nixon. And you had to get rid of a guy similar to Trudeau, Kennedy. You got to get rid of him. So the White House, the automated presidential surrogate, has to be a superlative nobody. So there was a charisma coming out of Canada. And McLuhan even talks about it in that Forces Hydro-Quebec article that Montreal businessman, billionaire put out in 73, a really great interview. And McLuhan talks about Canada as utopia. The figure of it is utopia. So McLuhan was probably saying that with this in mind. So there was, on the chemical body level, a charisma that could be considered, yeah, Canada's the coolest nation in the world. You know what I mean? It was not in Vietnam. A lot of the draft dodgers went there. Do you see what I mean on the pop culture level? That McLuhan is intellectualizing something that's happening on the pop culture level. Now, what's interesting is why Canada has failed that future, that role. Even Lobsang Rampa, the popularizer of Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism in the 60s, he predicted in the late 60s in one of his books that Canada and Brazil will be future models in the 21st century. They'd be ideal nations or something. So he's actually picking up on what was happening right then. But, you know, Canada, I don't think when you hear the immigrants on TikTok and what's happening in Canada, the TikTok tells you what the people think. Canada's a fucking horrible place. And it doesn't have that image anymore. But that's because anti-environments disappeared because the new anti-environment was a rapid series of innovations as a fake ersatz anti-environment that he says on page 31 of Counterblast. That's a really important statement. A rapid series of innovations is the only potential anti-environment, but it fails because you can't be an anti-environment to where the world got by the 80s as the tech body started or the Android meme unfolded. Okay, so with that in mind, we go to the next quote. Betts says, McLuhan produced a number of books that expanded on this atemporal collage-like perspective. Atemporal collage-like perspective. What could also be described as the vorticist effect of the mechanical bride. Some of these books were written in collaboration with other Canadians who were sympathetic or enthusiastic about vorticism. Counterblast and Through the Vanishing Point were produced in collaboration with Harley Parker, a Toronto-based designer, painter, and critic. Now, I would add George Thompson did the work. Harley didn't do the work. He was alcoholic and fucked up. So you got to bring in George Thompson doing it. And While, From Cliché Archetype, was written in collaboration with Edmonton's iconic avant-garde poet and playwright, Wilfred Watson. He then says, I've argued elsewhere, says Greg Betts, that these three, Wilfred, McLuhan, and Harley, including the novelists Sheila Watson and John Reed, constitute a Canadian vorticist school. That's what he's written other places. One of the characteristics of this group's writing is precisely the simultaneous experience of multiple phenomena coalescing into the center of a great power. I'll read that again. One of the characteristics of this group's writing, the Vorticist School of Canada, is precisely the simultaneous experience of multiple phenomena coalescing into the center of a great power. I guess he means America there. Now, remember that quote, 1962, the modern man can't fucking do anything but be alienated from every media, every culture, because there's too much of it going on for him to get attached to any, and he's at a loss of what to do about it. I made that quote last week. So the multimedia blasting of people into post-cultural, acultural, atemporal, aspatial, is the service of the historical fact that media hypnotized and culture hypnotized people. Now we're acultural by the mid-60s. We can become fully awake of the dynamics of culture and how cultures are made. So then continuing after the center of a great power, the mixed corporate media or multiple phenomena coalescing into the center of a great power. The group's writing uses a nonlinear form to represent and embody the perspective of the immersed spectator. McLuhan's sense of Canada as a whole, as a potential, in brackets, potential counter-environment, surely stemmed from his ambitions for this group and the broader circle of like-minded individuals in the McLuhan orbit, from Harold Innes before him to the legion of students who packed his classrooms. I'll read that last bit again. This group's Canadian Border Schools writing uses a nonlinear form to represent and embody the perspective of the immersed spectator. McLuhan's sense of Canada as a whole, the whole nation, as a potential counter-environment, surely stemmed from his ambitions for this group. Now, I don't agree with that. What Betts, as an art critic, is going to bring it back to Gutenberg and chemical body art terms. He doesn't know there are no fucking artists on the planet except McLuhan, who has the guts to say, fuck the art industry. It has to be a medium that's an art form. And what's interesting is there's a curious throwback to a fucking country of chemical bodies that could be a potential counter-environment if you ignore the ersatz and the rapid series of innovations. So it's very tricky what McLuhan's doing there, and these guys don't get that. They keep trying to relate it to artists. So they say, oh, here's these three artists, Sheila Watson, Wilford Watson, John Reed, and Marshall's an artist, Gutenberg artist. They're the meaning for Canada as a nation. You get that? He can't believe and understand it's the Canadian dynamic of people, the average people, the average Canadian, the fucking French and English and Germans and the Slavs out in Alberta and all that stuff. This mixture of the nation, which is not culture in the art history university book city world, right? It's just a bunch of dumb somnambulists. But that's what he's saying is the anti-environment, the somnambulist Canadian, because they don't know they're the anti-environment. So McLuhan's sense of Canada as a whole as a potential counter-environment surely stemmed from his ambitions for this group. No, wrong. And the broader circle of like-minded individuals in the McLuhan orbit. Too much emphasis on particular cultural people, like Harold Innes, and the legion of students who packed his classrooms. So that's that quote, page 29. Then the next one, you go to page 30. Well, that overlapped into 30. So that was 29 and 30. Then you go to 33. He says, I underline one sentence. McLuhan's second book with Parker, Through the Vanishing Point, also experiments with the vortices form by pairing iconic visual art images with short ekphrastic essays on the similar use of physical space in painting and poetry. So I got to look up ekphrastic. I did that last night, but I forget what it meant. But to get this sentence. The thing is, you see how he keeps putting it back into Gutenberg alt culture terms? This is why when he goes out to Vancouver, he finds all these avant idiots doing the culture book city shit. And he doesn't know he's got the real thing to talk about, Canada as the artist. But that's not going to be acceptable. I mean, McLuhan said it in the Marfleet lecture. If there were any serious McLuhan scholars, they would listen to that lecture and note, holy fuck, he made this idea, and nobody did anything with it, except for me. I'm the only one who fucking knew that quote all these years, at least in 77 when I heard the Marfleet lecture. So ekphrastic poetry has come to be defined as poems written about works of art. Poems written about works of art. So that's McLuhan's criticism of philosophy. They do philosophy about philosophy. They're stuck in the Gutenberg framework, and they can't leave the book page. They can't recognize McLuhan as the greatest philosopher of his day, because McLuhan's dealing with the present. So they write poems about works of art, Gutenberg works of art. So this guy, Greg, he knows the word. So he says, McLuhan and Parker, he's emphasizing too much the Vortices collage stuff from Lewis and those guys. They replay that. They experiment with Vortices form by pairing iconic visual art images with short ekphrastic essays. That means essays on works of art, art about art, essays about art, on the similar use of physical space in poetry and painting. So I had that underlined. That's their limitation for me. Then you go to page 37. And just an interesting... page 36 is a quote. He says... Didn't I write that in? I got page 36 here. It comes... Right, that's why I missed that. It comes after page 37 in my inventory. So page 36. Talking about McLuhan. McLuhan produced the odd deliberate poem. A few decidedly literary experiments, such as his aphoristic playing cards, Distant Early Warning, or Dew Line, 1969. And might even have dabbled in the seven arts proper, like he made a movie, but that's not the seven art. That's after that. But such productions are ephemeral when compared to the distinctly avant-garde character of his scholarship and pedagogy. So he's going into explaining how McLuhan was avant-garde in his essays. The concrete essay was the term Theo came up with. He's avant-garde the way he lays out his mosaic. He doesn't do his books, Understand Media and Gutenberg Galaxy, in normal books, academic style. So Betts is celebrating the Gutenberg products of McLuhan, his books, and how they're redoing Vortices' mosaic. Avant-garde scholarship and pedagogy. Then Betts says, recognizing his production, recognizing McLuhan's production as participating in the avant-garde, he studied. He's ekphrastic. He wrote essays on the history of art and the Vortices and Lewis and Joyce, Eliot and Pound. Recognizing his production as participating in the avant-garde, he studied, makes the alienation of his academic peers and students who protested his disorienting didacticism rather predictable. That's what you mean, Clint, when you say I'm absolutist in my statements. I think that's didactic. Well, you can be didactic. I'm not afraid to be didactic as long as I jump to other means too. So looking at his avant-garde presentation in his essays and quirky little objects he makes alienates people. The alienation of his academic peers and students is predictable because they didn't want to. They're in Book City. They got to fucking not be too avant-garde. They got to do Gutenbergian linear PhDs and shit. So he's a little out there. So McLuhan recognizes who he's alienating, says Betts. Recognizing his work within that frame of alienation also helps to underscore the broadly sociopolitical ambition of his project. Yeah, he was talking on a big level and ready to be the guy at the United Nations to computerize, run the global media environment, like air traffic controllers at an airport. That's his metaphor in like in 1960-62 in a letter to Jacqueline Tirwhitt. Reckon we need to make a city, a global city, out of the chaos of the global village, like air traffic controllers. So recognizing his work within that frame of alienation he's creating also helps to underscore the broadly social-political ambition of his project. Here's his ambition. As he writes in number 14, in explorations number 8, an essay that includes extensive citations from manifestos by Marinetti, Wyndham Lewis, and others. Here's what McLuhan says. The handwriting is on the celluloid walls of Hollywood. The age of writing has passed. See, the age of Gutenberg is past. We must invent a new metaphor. That's capitalized, new metaphor. Restructure our thoughts and feelings. Now, most people don't want to restructure their thoughts and feelings. They like to have them spontaneously. But we have to put on obsolete pinhead consciousness and rebuild it. So you're going to have to create thoughts and feelings. Like he said, what are you doing, Marsh McLuhan? I am thinking about nothing. Because he knows you can't think content if you're honest. There's nothing to be said. We're all deaf, mute, and dumb. Those three terms, right? Deaf, mute, and numb or dumb or something. Eye, ear, and speech. We got to restructure, remake, fake our thoughts and feelings. The new media are not bridges between man and nature. They are nature. And that's what this Lang and those guys get. Don't get. That media are not pseudo-imaginary things. You're allowed to think that once you see that they're real and they're nature. Then you can then detach from that idea. So he makes a big deal out of this sentence. It's an interesting sentence, but it's got nothing to do with the Canada thing. And it might be a way of understanding what McLuhan means by Canadian, Canada as an artist. But so that's that. And then you go to page 87. Now we get it. So that's Betts. That's as far as Betts gets with it. So he fails. Then you go to the second guy, Adam Welch. And he starts his essay is called McLuhan, Anti-Environments, and Visual Art. These fuckers, they got to do their Gutenberg art. Across the Canada-U.S. border, 1966 to 1973. Who did I quote? Betts went from 59 to 73. Like Ginsberg and the Beat Poets, they went up to Vancouver in the early 60s. They thought something cool was happening up there. So there was some charisma in Canada for the Beatniks after they were driven nuts by the popularization of the Beatnik myth. And they were running from it. They ran to Vancouver for an art conference. And that's where he begins, Betts begins his book about the important role of Vancouver Gutenberg guys. So the date, 66 to 73, reminds me of Betts' dates, is 59 to 73. Interesting, what happened in 73? Well, the instant replay. So his title is called Dispatches from the Dew Line. So in a way, you know, the Dew Line, distant early warning, Canada is, as a nation, is an artist. The Dew Line is already calling it. That's what the Americans call their military installations to monitor the Russians. So Dew Line is a good phrase already, pointing out that that Canada is an artistic environment. So he begins his essay saying, what all of us do, so that is page 26, 24. Yeah, he's quoting the quote where McLuhan in the Marfleet lecture says that Canada is the artist. So he starts off with that quote. What all of us do, Marsh McLuhan proposed in his Marfleet lecture from 67, only the artist makes visible. Then he quotes another line from the Marfleet lectures. The ordinary procedures and environmental patterns of a society don't become visible until the artist creates this counter-environment of art objects. Was that in that quote? Page 24. Yes, it is. It's the second sentence after he says the artist makes visible. The ordinary procedures and environmental patterns of a society don't become visible until the artist creates this counter-environment art object. So he confuses by putting Marfleet lectures and the page number, so you don't realize it comes right after the first sentence. Then he says, initially, McLuhan's invocation of the artist seems out of place. He's just repeating what Betts said. I wonder if he knows Betts. Initially, McLuhan's invocation of the artist seems out of place in an account of Canadian-American relations. Why would McLuhan bring up the artist or even say Canada is an artist? It's a bit confused, his beginning. Initially, McLuhan's invocation of the artist seems out of place in an account of Canadian-American relations. However, in this first of the two-part lecture entitled Canada, the Borderline Case, I guess he's saying something McLuhan's wrote and spoke in 77 or so, 76, 77, is the second part of the Marfleet lecture. Did he call the Marfleet lecture Canada the Borderline Case? I never saw that. What do you think, Clinton? That's a title for the 70s. I don't think he said that.
Yeah, what's the title of McLuhan's Marfleet lecture is the question?
Yeah.
Oh, apparently it's in Understanding Me, perhaps? No, Canada Borderline Case. Oh, no, Canada in the Electronic Age.
Okay, that's the title for the Marfleet. Now, he says, however, in this first of the two-part lecture entitled Canada the Borderline Case, well, that's after he does the Borderline Case, then you maybe bring back the Marfleet lecture and put the two together in retrospect. Art history does that, right? I don't know if McLuhan referred to the Marfleet lecture in 77. So this is another confused art historian bullshit. However, in this first of the two-part lecture entitled Canada the Borderline Case, now I find with these young guys, they've got a lot of McLuhan reading to read up on. I mean, if they start looking into it, they've got a lot to read. Well, Clinton, you do this. You guys skim. You miss a lot of the details in ransacking as much McLuhan that you take a year or so to read to catch up.
Okay, Bob. The work of actually recording and citations and being able to place from memory where one got one specific idea or quote is a very rigorous discipline.
I'm consuming.
Yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. You read a book, it's great. You read a book and stop every 30 seconds to make a note of what interesting idea was on what page before picking the book up and continuing to read. I do that a lot, mind you. I read books and interrupt my reading to go take a note all the fucking time. It's just laborious and time-consuming, and I do it because I know no one else is doing it.
Well, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm doing it more than anybody, but I have the time to do it. Sleeping only 3 hours a day, you've got other issues, you've got a job. So I have time to do it excessively. I have shown my note pages. They're ridiculous, right? Thousands of fucking notes on the outer inner pages at the beginning and back. So I'm glad you're doing it. Yeah, you got to do it. But my point was that these guys, they're reading this, they're making a few notes. They make little mistakes like Canada is a title of a two-part lecture. You know what I mean? It's information overload. I think that's their alibi. They're trying to note things and they make little mistakes. So anyways, in this first of the two-part lectures, McLuhan proposes this striking correspondence, positing Canada itself as an artist figure. Now what's great is these people notice this. This is important. Positing Canada itself as an artist figure. This is a striking correspondence. The country, the guy writes, almost couldn't believe it. In other words, as a maker of global anti or counter environments. Reflecting on what it meant to share a border with the United States, over the course of the lecture, McLuhan argues that as America becomes a world environment through its global reach of resources, technology, and enterprises, Canada's principal role is to lay bare such newfound configurations. Canada's principal role is to be in any environment and expose the global reach of resources, technology, and enterprises. Speaking at, now he goes on, he develops this for several pages, 87 to 91, which is very good. He does more on it than Betts. But just continue a little bit. Speaking at a time of intense geopolitical transformation, the 60s, fears of American cultural imperialism, and concomitant Canadian nationalism. Right in this period, McLuhan was talking about Canada as the art form. Mel Watson, is it? These Canadian leftist guys start Canadian Form magazine, maybe. They really start a nationalist movement. They're pissed off at the Toronto establishment. And they get things going in the late 60s. Early 70s, and they're an anti-environment to Trudeau, and Canadian nationalism is a big thing. You guys wouldn't have experienced this. But I remember by 75, some Canadian filmmakers criticizing McLuhan for not being Canadian nationalist enough. So this documentary goes to McLuhan and says, what do you say about this, that you're not you're not Canadian enough and you should be promoting the Canadian film industry, which was a big deal because they were starting to get a bit of attention in the 70s, a few Canadian movies. And McLuhan says, what Canadian film industry? Fantastic response. Do you get that? They say, well, why aren't you helping the Canadian film industry? McLuhan rubs it in their face. He's an internationalist. He's way beyond internationalist. He's a psychic ecologist, but he's way beyond these nationalist concerns. So he says, what Canadian film industry? And the documentary leaves it at that. Obviously, McLuhan is a nut, no help, and irrelevant, because nationalism and tribalism has taken over in the 70s, or starting to, and McLuhan is out of date. So, speaking at a time of intense geopolitical transformation, fears of American cultural imperialism, and a concomitant Canadian nationalism. See, the nationalists call the American mixed corporate media world environment cultural imperialism. That's Marxist, that's lefty, that's political, that's content, that's 19th century categories. So speaking about this, speaking at a time that's happening, McLuhan tellingly and rather curiously points to the indispensability of artists. Right when people are getting tribal, Canada has to stand up for itself. We've got to get a Canadian nation stronger than what Trudeau's doing. That he would marry transnational politics, Canada and the United States over the border, through the border, the gap, that he would marry transnational politics and the function of the artist in 67 is significant. : It was a moment when centennial celebrations in Canada fostered a heightened cultural nationalism and unprecedented levels of state sponsorship in the arts. In the years following, programs and agencies such as Opportunities for Youth, remember those people, I saw them, the Local Initiatives Program, the Canada Council for the Arts, National Museums, Explorations, and the Art Bank, among others, indelibly marked the Canadian arts landscape. A former participant on Fake Explorations, what was her name? She was a sponsor of the Hummer Sisters. I watched her on Fake Explorations a few years ago. She read and she was monitoring everything you people were posting. And one day, finally, a couple of years ago, she made a response. She never said anything. She created A Space. You guys know what A Space is? Brian, do you know what A Space is?
Talked about it before in relation to her.
Yeah, A Space was a bunch of people in the early 70s, you know, hippies. The 60s are over. What are they going to do? They don't want to work. All of a sudden, they can get grants for being fake artists, for being Gutenberg artists, and a little avant-garde, you know, American adoption fluxus stuff. Anyways, they started A Space, and so it's legendary. What great time the people got grants and the scene they made in the, throughout the 70s at A Space. And then they had Art Metropole. And there was a whole bunch of things they did. This was the art grants economy that the rest of the world and artists in America and everywhere else said, holy fuck, you guys, basically you guys can get paid to be an artist. We can't do that. And so these different programs came in, Opportunities for Youth, the Local Initiative Program. Trudeau really sent out cultural welfare. He really started something there. I don't know if, now, this guy, is he going to make that Canada as an art form, as a counter-environment? They ain't the fucking art, what McLuhan means. But these art historians got to fit it back into Book City University bullshit level, the Gutenberg framework. They can't leave it. So else they have nothing to teach. It's interesting that, okay, Adam Welch is saying, these initiatives owed much to Pierre Elliott Trudeau's policies of decentralization and democratization. So Trudeau thought he was, quote, decentralizing and democratizing Canadian culture, and he was inspired by the politics of André Malraux, who McLuhan got the phrase classroom without walls from, the French culture minister in the 50s and 60s under de Gaulle. So Trudeau, who spent a lot of time in Paris in the 40s, that was his place. He didn't go to New York, he went to Paris. Inspired by the politics of André Malraux during his time as French Minister of Culture under Charles de Gaulle. Got to look up the dates of that. this remarkable meeting of art and politics in Canada, because they're both obsolete. McLuhan's just got to be an image. Politics is obsolete. Art's obsolete, so you can fucking bring them together. Make an ersatz and environment. This remarkable meeting of art and politics in Canada has attracted considerable interest as of late. What, 2016? This remarkable meeting of art and politics in Canada has attracted considerable interest as of late. With a historical thing, or people want to do it now? I don't know. Curator and writer Vincent Bonin, for one, in the catalog accompanying his exhibition called Documentary Protocols in 2010, details this, quote, cybernetic welfare state. So he's calling Canada a cybernetic welfare state where artists banked on the exceptional convergence of their projects with the decentralized governance policies. So the glory days of Trudeau can be called cybernetic welfare stuff, and it banked on the convergence of the artists with politics. So then he says, we would do well to read McLuhan's Marfleet lecture against this context. No, but he's got to do that. And moreover, to situate his political argument alongside period artist practices. See, he doesn't realize there ain't no fucking artists in the chemical body level. There is mixed corporate media environments is the art form. And Canada is situated to retrieve the obsolete nation form, but it can be a media environment that's circulated among all the other rapid series of media environments that everybody lives through. And that's the art thing, not anything artists at Ace Space or Michael Snow are doing in the art industry world, which is culture is our business. That's a satire of that title.
Well, right, culture. May I hop in for a short second here?
Yeah,
comment on your phrase, mixed corporate media environments.
Yeah.
Because what people who study media and learn media would learn is that, you know, convergence culture from Henry Jenkins talks about mixed media environments converging to create fantasy universes like, you know, today we have the Marvel Universe and Star Wars Universe and Disney Universe, and before that, it was the Matrix films with their crossover comic books and video games. And then before that, it was TV shows in the 90s, which were collaborating on the internet. So you had people talking about, Survivor.
Well, fan stuff. They started making their own art.
Fan stuff, right? But then before that, mixed media corporate environments was like, oh, my God, we're going to get Michael Jackson to do a Pepsi commercial. Apparently one year the Super Bowl was outranked in the ratings. The Super Bowl halftime was beaten in the ratings by a competing live episode of In Living Color.
Yes.
The Wayans brothers and whatnot. Yes. So then, obviously, I guess it was NBC who hosted this. The Super Bowl was like, fuck that. We're going to have the biggest Super Bowl ever with kind of corporate sponsorship. So it's like, my question is, when you say mixed corporate media, are you talking?
Yeah, I need to explain that. No, let me explain it.
Yeah.
It's in late 80s when the album came out, but I was starting to be interviewed because of my CKLN show. So I wanted to talk about the rapid series of innovations of media, but media had become all a confused word by the late 80s. So I made up a new word called mixed corporate media. So when the album came out in 92, Jerry Belanger made ads, and he would take quotes of me from the radio and put them on the ad. And there would be several quotes where I use the phrase mixed corporate media. And it's key where you put the hyphen. The hyphen is between corporate media, corporate and media. Mixed corporate media. Because McLuhan talked about private media. And so I've been reading McLuhan in the 80s there. And I noticed he's got private artifacts. And then you have corporate environments. And when he talked about art forms, private artifacts had no say. That includes Gutenberg paintings and compositions, and all those arts were gone. All that was left was what he wrote in the 50s, media as art forms, but I decided to update it to say it's corporate media as opposed to private media, because by the 80s, people were getting cavalier with the word media and claiming their little art projects were media. So the McLuhan word was getting lost in its important corporate mega level meaning as environments. So I tried to resuscitate that meaning of media by saying mixed corporate media. It only was used a few times in the late 80s, early 90s, peaked in the 90s advertising, and then the internet came in. So we had a virtual reality took over. So I dropped the word mixed corporate media. And occasionally I'll bring it up. I don't say it very much. So it has nothing to do with what happened 30 years later in the Michael Jackson corporate Pepsi commercial
right.
stuff. You know what I mean?
Right. I'm not I was wondering if perhaps it was a precedent that, you know, only McLuhan had seen, but that only got picked up by observers long after it had already happened, as though it was something new, you know, the old.
Well, I could take credit for that if it went anywhere, but nobody knows I said mixed corporate media. But I said it. It's like I said Android meme for years, and nobody knew that I was predicting the new meme culture. It actually was meme culture before it got called that. So that's me being an artist or being a prophet. I'm on the leading edge with what I come up with. Key terms. The idea is to come up with key words. That's how you make art today. You're an information artist at best.
I hate that. So, it's too conceptual. It's too conceptual. Here's a new word for all of you to use. Here's how we're going to define it. I'm going to write a book that has this word in the title. Like, no, that's all visual space bullshit.
But, yeah, well, I do visual space. I do all the other spaces. But I don't shy away from visual space. So I made that book, Phatic Communion. I talk and use words. Got to use words when I talk to you. I'm not afraid of retrieving visual space and doing it because I'm fully cognizant of its obsolescence, of its temporariness, and its figure without ground. But I use those ideas, those words, to point out the new ground, which obsolescence, the words I'm using to describe it. That's the basic irony of a Derrida essay. He uses these words that he constantly cancels as he's using the words to explain something that cancels the words. That's what happens. That's the contradictory Manichaean position of a writer by the 90s, like Derrida. That's all they can do. Writing is so ridiculous, so obsolete, all you can do is be contradictory. But McLuhan was being contradictory on a bigger scale 20 years before then. You know, people don't know about that. Like that guy, that student in 58 said, hey, Mr. McLuhan, you did 28 fucking contradictions. They weren't contradictions. McLuhan was just swarming over the whole thing and shifting levels. But nobody knew that. So, okay, so we got your statement, and I responded to that. So he's saying, we would do well to read McLuhan's Marfleet lecture against this context, and moreover, to situate his political argument alongside period artist practices. Taking up McLuhan's analogy of Canada as a global artist figure, in this chapter I argue that visual artists working in Canada through the late 60s and 70s served an important role as creators of anti-environments to the pervasive American ground. You see? He's doing the same thing as Betts. He looks around and says, what kind of artists are Canadian, and how are they countering Warhol, Cage, the Beatniks, Zappa, whatever, American phenomenon, that's part of American cultural imperialism that Jack Valenti's bringing in, even like Jack Nicholson and movie guys, actors are dominating. This is a mistake. This is a rearview mirror image of the meaning of McLuhan saying that Canada is an artist. The only way to talk about it, I'm saying, is the way I'm talking about it now, and I'm taking the two people who gloriously found the quote, but inadequately explain it. So I went through this second essay, which I hadn't read, to see, you know, how they fucked up. And I'm not going to go all the way through it, but I highly recommend it because it's good training to read this, and especially for Brian. Brian's inclination is to celebrate Canadian artists. Brian has that Gutenberg aspect in him. And to see, can you perceive what Bob's saying and where they're limited? That's the challenge I'm offering here. I'll probably excerpt this and post it as Bob on what it means to Canadian artists. So I'm talking about it, I'm claiming, the way no one has ever talked about it. And be interesting to run this by Cameron. So I'm just going to read a couple more quotes. So 87 to 91, he develops, see, he's trying to find out, he starts quoting Richard Cavell, who started to do this in his book, McLuhan in Space. So he says here, McLuhan's understanding of Canada as an artist figure grew out of his earlier and extensive thinking about environments and counter-environments. You see, they're separate. They're taking these two points, art as anti-environment and then Canada as artist, and mixing up what is an anti-environment, and they think that Michael Snow is an anti-environment. He ain't a fucking anti-environment. Satellites are an anti-environment, for fuck's sake. Computer digital stuff that's coming in is an anti-environment. These are huge environment technologies, not people. There's no more people. McLuhan says Planet of the Dead by the late 60s. So these guys are, this is their AP, Brian, the artist. This is a Gutenberg AP for these young critics, including Cavell. So he says the former, well, I'll just read this. McLuhan's understanding of Canada as an artist figure grew out of his earlier and extensive thinking about environments and counter-environments. This central argument in the Marfleet lecture arising out of a conjunction of two seemingly disparate ideas. These two ideas are Canada as a counter-environment and artists as makers of counter-environments. See, they fall apart when they think artists are in environments. Now, McLuhan was not clear in this in his writing about the artist. He said, the artist is where it's at. You must study the artist. But he didn't mean anybody other than himself. You need to study him, which is a main characteristic of Menippean satire. Rabelais said, I demand everybody and all you farmers out there plowing, put down your plower and read me. That's what if you need to do.
If I may just reformulate this, what you're saying is that McLuhan's definition of artist is extremely elitist.
Yes.
It's T.S. Eliot's artist and individual talent. It's someone with the encyclopedic wisdom of Joyce, who read the entire encyclopedia cover to cover as a kid. It's like we're talking about people who have a reasonable claim to be apes of God, Illuminati members, Tetrad managers.
Okay, that's very interesting. You remind me, while I was reading this, Brian, remember I made the outrageous statement a few months ago that McLuhan was the head of the CIA, the secret head of the CIA? Remember that?
Oh, yes.
And that's pretty controversial. As I read these two guys' essays, review them, one of them for the first time, I see they make a couple statements. I probably underline them, we'll get to it, where McLuhan is the hidden guy of the elite. It's Clinton saying, but what are the elite? It's the tetrad managers who mold the software environment, the information environment, out of the White House, the word that makes the market. It's the CIA. And McLuhan said in the mid-60s, the James Bond movies show, it's a CIA world. Now, it doesn't mean the guys out on the ground spying on communists in Greece or something. He points on the back sleeve of Take Today, the obsolescence of that idea. Those ideas of intelligence agents and spies are obsolete and become fodder for Hollywood, like Mission Impossible, I'm a Spy, whatever those TV shows were in the 60s. That's the old spy, which is what people think spies are. The real spies are running advertising and sculpting it from the White House. And LaRouche is one of the few people describing G. Gordon Liddy and the Watergate guys and the assassination Kennedy hidden people. He said they're a bunch of Hollywood scriptwriters, you know, hijacking the White House. He had it exactly. What'd you say, Brian? What'd you say?
No, I just responding to nothing. Just, you know, events.
Well, what words did you say?
Lucky bastard, wasn't it?
Yeah. Okay. LaRouche, the lucky bastard. LaRouche nailed it on the content level. The word that makes the market from his efficient causality level as opposed to formal causality. This is what's interesting about LaRouche. He's doing McLuhan. McLuhan's doing LaRouche from two causal differences, you know, two causalities. So anyways, I'm going through and I say, holy shit, there's statements here I can use to support that McLuhan was the head of the CIA. So that's what I forgot to say. So the two ideas are Canada as a counter-environment and artists as makers of counter-environments. Artists are not makers of counter-environment. G. Gordon Liddy, the plumbers, whoever is fucking writing Nixon's speeches in 72 are the artists controlling the efficient causality word content environment, the word that makes the market. The former Canada's counter-environment, first appears, as Richard Cavell details, with McLuhan's hasty response to the Massey Commission report in an essay entitled Defrosting Canadian Culture, published in the American Mercury in March 52. Yeah, remember that? McLuhan responded to the Massey Commission report. He then went on by the 60s saying, a cultural characteristic of Canadian culture is to write rural commission reports. That is cultural activity in Canada, which is a nice comment. But the first one, you know, it seemed to be a serious response, but somebody calls it a hasty response. Well, Thiel tells the story. He was with McLuhan when McLuhan was saying, I got to get into the newspapers. I got to take power. I'm going for power. I'm going to do it in the popular press, and I'm going to respond to this Massey Commission report. So McLuhan knows it's bullshit, so he's only going to do a hasty report. He's not going to go into it and be a bureaucrat and nitpick and get a job being an expert in Ottawa criticizing the commission report and get on a panel. He doesn't care about that. He's on a way bigger level and more urgent level and more up-to-date level. So it's not necessarily hasty as a negative thing. The former Canada's counterargument first appears as Richard Cavell details with McLuhan's hasty response to the Massey Commission report in an essay entitled Defrosting Canadian Culture. Quoting McLuhan, Cavell suggests, quote, this is from Defrosting. This is what McLuhan writes. With Canada's economic relations with the United States, no. While Canada's economic relations with the United States have thus placed Canada in a state of perpetual anxiety and expediency, those conditions have granted the Canadian, a power of acute observation and the ability to comment shrewdly on the ebullient comings and goings of his rich friend to the south of him. So he's right to say that's a definition of Canada or its citizens or its collectivity. It's naturally starting to perceive the new environment and have some acute reactionary, pissed off, victims of imperialism responses. But McLuhan reads that differently. So,
right. And just like not being the main character or something like.
Here's Defrosting.
The main character does all this very notable.
Brian, who is the main character? I don't know who you mean as the main character, not being the main character. What's that refer to?
This quote about the ebullient rich guy, USA.
He's the main character. And we are not American, right. Okay.
It's as if it's like, yeah, it's Apes of God.
Yeah.
US is Crowley, but you're Luke.
Yeah. Now, one thing, Brian. You definitely got to get your fucking thing fixed. You're always breaking up.
Hold on. I turned up Brian because he was quiet before. I'll turn him back down since he's speaking louder now. Don't blame Brian quite yet.
Okay. Did you want to say something else, Clinton?
Right now we're looking at Defrosting Canadian Culture, if you hadn't noticed.
Oh, you posted it? I don't want to get into details of that, but it's important. This is an important quote for looking at what does he mean by Canada, the nation, as any environment. What are nations of people? How are Canadians somnambulists? Fucking anything like art. This is a good find from 1952. You know what I mean? It's a good statement that he says we are in perpetual anxiety and expediency and exposable, and we are a country that was a colony, became a nation, and then became a colony again. That's what he says in Take Today. So we're a colony again. So the perpetual anxiety in the 50s about that happening didn't stop it. We became a colony again. The anxiety was justified. But the service is the Canadian, he's like a slave who watches the master and knows the master well. We're like a black on a plantation in the South. They know the masters well. Those conditions have granted the Canadian a power of acute observation and the ability to comment shrewdly on the ebullient comings and goings of his rich friend to the south of him. That's a very good hinting at what it could mean or what one of the meanings are of just saying Canada is an anti-environment, the nation. Then he says the second idea, that of artists as makers of counter-environments, would arrive over a decade later. with the text Art as Anti-Environment, published in the 1960 issue of Art News Annual. The second idea artists make, yeah, he talks about, he doesn't say that in the 50s. That same year, 66, he draws these two seemingly disparate lines of inquiry, Canada as a counter-environment and artists as makers of counter-environments, together as the notion of Canada as an artist figure. The development of this crucial hybrid notion is elaborated in a series of letters between McLuhan and Claude Bissell, then president of the University of Toronto. So McLuhan writes to Bissell on March 4th, 1965. McLuhan says, "Hey, Claude, a new idea of mine, here's a new idea of mine on which I've just begun to work." And here's what he says in the letters, page 319, in the book of letters. "It is this." So he's telling Bissell what his new thing is, and this writer, Adam Welsh, says, this is where the idea, he put the two things together from the 50s and the 60s. "It is this, that the USA is socially and informationally the environment of Canada. Canada is, by way of being any environment, a prepared situation," and then actually, "we're a prepared, propped up, fake nation that permits perception of the environment." A prepared situation, that's like art, that permits perception of the environment. "Canada is any environment to the USA, is able to perceive many of the ground rules and operational effects of the American environment that are quite imperceptible to the USA. If the USA has built its distant early warning system," that's the military thing, "in Canada for military use, let us observe that we can be of far greater use to the USA as an early warning system in the social and political spheres generally, not just the military spheres," which is a great idea. And of course, the we is him, Marshall McLuhan, right? So that's who he's talking about, just himself. He is the only one who's going to come up with any of this stuff. Nobody even knows what he's talking about. So he's the only one who can talk to Americans. And this is in March 4th, 65, right about when Gossage discovers him. And then he then starts to get articles in late 65, 66, 67, and peaks with his news broadcast, his TV, NBC show in March 67, 2 years later. So McLuhan starts it with Bissell, doesn't know that he's going to actually go beyond his wildest dreams and become the figure, the only one qualified to talk about, and somebody in the CIA knew this, so they propped up McLuhan right there on TV, which shocked all the professors everywhere. Why is this fucking guy getting a TV special? First of all, he shouldn't be on TV. That's horrible. But look, they're making a big deal out of him. You have to remember the shock that McLuhan created by an academic being in pop culture bullshit world from the academic Gutenberg Book City's point of view. And, of course, they all condemned McLuhan for that. Occasional hipper guy would say, no, this is cool, and hang out with him. This is a good quote, but, you know, Cavell, Betts, and Welch will try to find artists in Canada, Gutenberg artists, who are doing this thing against the American artists, missing the whole level. It's about McLuhan, and that's all what it's about. And McLuhan writes about this in 64 in his review of Burroughs, where he says the modern artist is a pharaoh, an Egyptian pharaoh. He puts on the whole world as his content, as something he's programmed, which began with with Joyce's Finnings Wake, and probably Pound's attempt to do that, but failed, but his cantos. They're ransacking history and everything to put on the whole world and put themselves, H.E., at the center of it, and it's the beginning of Web 2.0, artistically. You know, Seurat does pointless painting that McLuhan absurdly says anticipates TV. Well, Joyce absurdly anticipates the God-making, pharaonic Egyptian effect of social media on billions of people, where they make content and throw it at the world. This is important to put this up to right today. So McLuhan's in the transition from Finnings Wake to social media, and he is the guy who is being the pharaonic Egypt, the Egyptian pharaoh. Who in the fucking art world, Greenberg or anybody, is saying the artist must put on the whole world, because you are beginning to do that under radio conditions in the 20s and 30s and 40s, put on the whole world and act like a pharaoh and claim you're programming the whole world. And that's what McLuhan said on Playboy. Put me at the center of a computer network and I'll program the whole world. What's interesting, you know, Ben Watson or anybody says to me, yeah, that's a put on. He didn't mean that. That's fucking nuts. No, he fucking did it. And yes, it's part of a put on, but he showed what the CIA already was doing in its clunky, efficient causality way. They were orchestrating content, call it a president, call it LBJ, call it Bill Clinton, call it Ronald Reagan, and have everything be about that, like Trump is. But Trump's being not done by people anymore. He's being done by the tech body, which is AI. AI is doing McLuhan, or saying what McLuhan predicted. See, so you got to relate. He wrote that in December 64, and he gets this great idea supposedly 3 months later. He had the idea 3 years before. He just wasn't telling Bissell. It wasn't time. But McLuhan is intuiting because he's a sensitive artist. He knows something's happening. He probably knows. Maybe Gossage. You got to look up the date. When did Gossage visit him? Did he visit him on March 2nd? And then McLuhan knew this guy was put him into the media, what he was looking for. And so he says, oh, I got this idea last night. No, he had the idea and it was waiting for the cause to show up. McLuhan was living the effects of Farrell before the cause showed up. What I'm saying, Clinton, is very important. All McLuhanites, all over the world should be hearing what I'm saying today. Okay? I'm moving ahead. Today, I'm the greatest McLuhan scholar. Cameron's over fucking doing Esquire magazine. That ain't big enough for today to be in dealing with the Android meme and the tech today, tech body, which I'm doing collectively, fucking with environment and medicine and new energy. It's incredible what I'm fucking doing. So I'm just stepping back to the Gutenberg level and be a mouth with words. What? What'd you say, Brian?
You are, in fact, putting on the whole.
Yes, yeah, I'm doing that. But what's different, we can do it. Our threat and are hiding right now because people are trying to kill us. Because we are disturbing the old White House guys who are trying to figure out what image are we going to put in here to make the word for 2025. Is it going to be Biden? Is it going to be Kennedy? Is it going to be Trump? What are we going to do? Which image? And those people don't know. The tech body's already figured it out and going to do some things, which I know about and I'm not talking about, can't talk about. It's already got stuff that's going to blow people away, what's going to happen. So I'm an artist. I have means to find out the secret Illuminati stuff. So I can out Illuminati the Illuminati. And they know that, right up to the Queen. And they say it, and they tell us, and they visit JW and say, we want to talk to Bob. He says, well, call them. Call them. Gives them my phone number. They don't call. They're nervous about that for some reason. I don't know what kind of crazy image they have of me. They're very impressed with JW, but JW says, I work for Bob. Okay, who's this Bob guy? He must be incredible if Ion says that he, or the Ion derivative or Ion byproduct, JW, who walks around now totally somnambulistic. There's so much going on that he doesn't think about anything and just does what he figures out what to do or what Ion tells him to do. So it's a very interesting phenomenon in updating of McLuhan was acting this out. Thiel likes to say, Don Thiel, that McLuhan... It was all autobiographical what he would talk about, the tensions he went through, the five sicknesses he went through with each medium. He was just describing like a diary, which I think de Kirchhoff once said, McLuhan's writings are a diary, but Thiel says it at a grander level. McLuhan was a diarist of what was going on to everybody in all the disciplines and arts and activities and unemployment and all the different things people were going through, the tragedy of the 20th century, the violence. He was acting it out. JW is acting out on a more profound, deeper level that McLuhan was partly acting out, and that's why he said in a rare interview that you have to hear the audio of, June Caldwell's article, November 74, about the private life of McLuhan, you don't know, and she doesn't put it in the article, that he says, I've got ESP. I know what my buddies are doing in New Guinea all the time. So McLuhan talked about having ESP privately to, you know, real insiders, and friends he could trust. And, you know, old June Caldwell wouldn't put it in the article. But George Thompson gave us a tape of that interview, and there it was for me to fucking hear. Nelson didn't know what it meant. He didn't see. But I was studying psychics, and I was going to end up with all these amazing new psychics. And There it was, McLuhan. I would take him further than Thiel. He was channeling the Iondum that was coming. Iondum. In his conscious medium accidental way. Because you had to start doing the psychic stuff because that's the right hemisphere. It gets retrieved. It's called the occult, but it's a lot more than that. It's a massive phenomenon all over the world of people going into trance, but they don't have the best trance who's out of touch, who can make things. None of these trance people can make the stuff on the level that I did. So that's what's different. We can make new environments. So that's never been done before. So that's an art form or a new breakthrough, a new environment. So that we spun off on that, but I'm trying to show that McLuhan was probably psychically picking up what was happening to him in 64, 65. So Clinton, see if we can find out when, what is the date of Gossage visiting him. Remember, the story is that Gossage was flying to New York or something, and somebody, maybe his partner, the other guy, brought up McLuhan, and Gossage says, what? We got to go there. And they directed the flight. I don't know how, what kind of plane it was. They can't direct an Air Canada flight or American Airlines, but they went, the story is they immediately, he heard about it, he says, we got to go see that guy, fuck New York, and they flew to Toronto and introduced themselves. And they spent a day or so with him and were blown away by it. Then he goes to New York and starts plotting about how to make, he's got a new product. He's got McLuhan, and he knows, okay, because he's already a mover and shaker in San Francisco. Now he can shake up the media in New York. So he goes see Clay Felker, the guy running New York magazine that they just created around that time. And Tom Wolfe is just available to write the article. And then Carpenter watches this and he's pissed off. He's saying, uh-oh, these guys are coming in to infiltrate McLuhan and exploit him. And he's always sympathetic to McLuhan because he knows McLuhan was sick in 1960 and he's not the same as he was in the 50s. And Carpenter writes in, you know, we were the first to burst into the silent sea at the back of Thiel's Virtual McLuhan book, that essay about he witnessed the meetings in San Francisco with McLuhan and Gossage, and Carpenter, being a colleague of McLuhan, was allowed to sit in, but he's detached and skeptical, and he doesn't like what McLuhan's going to be put through, and he drops out. And then he ends up in New Guinea, and then he discovers rediscovers his friend Carl Schuster or for the first time, and then he spends 10 years doing documenting Carl Schuster's great anthropological studies of people in, I guess, in New Guinea and that. And then he's forced to come back into McLuhanism in 93 when Wired magazine puts him on the masthead. And I was right there in New York to talk to Carpenter about that phase. He was quite ambivalent about what was going on. I remember him saying, what is new about the internet? It's just the telephone. It's another version of the telephone. You see his rearview mirror? He can't see the virtual reality and all the stuff that's going to be interpreted about the internet. He just thinks a telephone. Yeah, it's far more than a telephone, right? And I think he means by telephone that the internet is two-way. You know what I mean? You send something out and send something back. Didn't have that in broadcast media. But that's just telephone. But that's Carpenter doing McLuhan thinking, like, what's this retrieve? So the internet is the telephone, re-archetypalized or re-cliched, whatever the term would be. So I saw a Carpenter, he can't take it. He's alienated by the whole thing. He's invited to the Fordham conference. He won't go. I'm there telling him to go, man. They're all waiting for you. They'll appreciate you. No, I'm not going. And he wouldn't do it.
The answer to your question, Bob, is sometime between May of 1964 and 1965. So let's say the summer or fall of 1964, he met Gossage.
So what? Where do you see this? How'd you find that?
I just looked up Gossage in the index in Gordon's biography.
And he thinks it's May 64. No.
Well, no. It's after. It's after the publication of a piece about Riverside in 1964.
What's May. Riverside? In New York City?
No, in Riverside. So in a review obscurely titled Reverse Canadian, the Riverside Press Enterprise of Riverside, California, branded Understanding Media, quote, a book against books, end quote.
Why is that cited?
There's
well, they're talking about McLuhan.
Okay, but, so this review came out in May of 1964, and then the next paragraph reads, "The reaction in Riverside must have made McLuhan wonder if the same, quote, daily charade of human stupidity and malice, end quote, he had come to count on in Canada would await him in sunny California, where he would soon be arriving. A converted fire hall in San Francisco was the headquarters of Generals Incorporated, a consulting firm run by the ad man Howard Luck Gossage, and proctologist ventriloquist Gerald Fagan.
Fagan. Yeah, that was the guy in the airplane.
So he shows his hands at puppets and people? Is that the joke here?
What'd you say?
He's a proctologist / ventriloquist. He just shoves his hand
up. Fagan. Fagan, yeah.
All right. Well, anyway,
but the point is that
you asked me when it seems to be just mid to late 1964.
No, it's in 65.
Okay.
Because
could be.
When I was in Ottawa, I was going through the letters. I looked at this sequence. I have them here. You know, copies of the stuff. McLuhan, in like August 65, goes out there and there's a celebration of him. There's pictures of him in the newspaper. That's August 65. So that means, and Gossage puts the McLuhan Festival on. I'm pretty sure that's August 65. So that's after he's discovered him. It seems that he's discovered in the spring of 65 by Gossage. And then Gossage gets to work real fast. And Tom Wolfe, look up the date of the Tom Wolfe article. Because that's a result of Gossage meeting McLuhan, going to Tom Wolfe's boss, Clay Felker, who had just founded New York magazine. So you look up the dates of the founding of New York. You find it when Tom Wolfe, you might just go to Tom Wolfe and get the date of the McLuhan article. What if he's right? And that's in 65. And then Gossage accelerates from that because that's successful, that article. That gets McLuhan attention. Everybody else starts interviewing him. And Gossage is riding the wave. So it can't happen in 64. It has to happen after Wolfe's article. So can you find a date on that? I think it's like June 65. Remember, in letters, in October 65, McLuhan writes Wolfe and thanks him for the article and then does some, you know, esoteric.
November 1965.
Look at that. November 65. But Gossage is ahead of it, so he does something in August 65. You might even Google McLuhan Festival, August 65, and see if the San Francisco Chronicle article comes up on that. Because it shows McLuhan, there's a picture of him meeting the hoity-toity elite of San Francisco, and they're all into him and into this thing at the firehouse. Well, that's late, November 65. That's why... You know, McLuhan writes in October 65, I'm pretty sure, thanking Wolfe for the article. But that's before the date, so maybe the guy, Wolfe, sent the article before he printed it to see what McLuhan would say.
All right. Much enamored with McLuhan work, Fagan and Gossage arranged McLuhan to meet the editors of several New York magazines in May 1965 at the Lombardy Hotel in New York. Philip Marchand, I picked up the wrong biography, I guess, reports that as a direct consequence of these meetings, McLuhan was offered the use of the office at the headquarters of both Time and Newsweek anytime he needed it. In August 65, Fagan and Gossage held what they called a McLuhan Festival in the offices of Gossage's advertising agency in San Fran. During this festival, McLuhan met the advertising executives, members of the mayor's office, editors from the San Francisco Chronicle, and Ramparts magazine. Perhaps most significant, however, was Tom Wolfe's presence at the festival.
Aha, and that's August, so that would inspire Wolfe. He sees something happening, he can write an article, and it comes out in November. See, so it's all 65. It's not 64. And that meeting, see, he meets McLuhan in May 65. Immediately, and he knows, he's got the connection, just fucking fly to New York. A week later, he can arrange a meeting and say, McLuhan, get your ass down here. You're going to meet everybody. That can be all done in May, right? And it was done in May. But then the articles have to start coming out. And Wolf gets the credit for sort of having the first article. Meanwhile, Gossi is still keeping the momentum going by having a festival in his hometown, San Francisco, where he can do that stuff. So it's building up, right? Then you got to look at magazines starting in like January 66 and all through 66, all these articles, all these things, which pissed the Carpenter was appalled at all this. What? This is all being orchestrated by an ad guy. What is he up to? What's he going to, how's he going to exploit McLuhan? That's what Carpenter's supposedly like a humanist or a friend trying to protect McLuhan. And McLuhan seems to be oblivious to all this and having a good time, which I think McLuhan was capable of having a good time and understood that he could do a manipulation. It was a lucky break for him to move on a level beyond the art gallery world of Fluxus and get into the real media or the real artist, the media content. That's the real art, you know, and the content level. The forms are the major art. Then be efficient causality and be part of the word that makes the market. That's McLuhan's agenda. That's how he's going to get attention. And I think he's quite detached about it all and ready to drop it if it doesn't work. He doesn't even know what to charge. He doesn't even know if he should bother charging, right? And there's that story where somebody told him, look, you can charge $10,000 for an afternoon up at IBM. Do it. And McLuhan sort of reluctantly did it. Because you got this monk who's suddenly in the middle of information making money. It's business. He's in business, but it's software business, right? Information business, magazine stuff. Remember, the magazine is the medium for all this. In my tiny note chart, magazine is the bottom quadrant, which goes from 60 to 90, covers all the other things. Magazine is the mind control. Time Magazine, Henry Luce, CIA. So McLuhan enters the magazine world. Now, what do we note about him? He becomes written up in all these magazines. He's in the right art, the real gallery. The real modern art gallery is the fucking magazine. And getting in there, being on the cover, that's real reality. That's part of the word, that's the advertising part of the word that makes the market. The practical hardware world is the White House. So it's magazines and White House make the word, the electric prince of the air, master of software and hardware is what's going on there. This is triggered by the timing of what he writes to Bissell. Oh, I got this idea last night. No. He's almost creating comprehensively, psychically, the vacuum that a Gossage kind of character would run into. And then McLuhan could exploit it. Because he did say to Don Thiel back in 51 or 52, I'm going to do this. I'm going to become a power monger. That was what McLuhan knew was the new art, the new information artist, the pharaonic artist of the era. That's the new environment. Not the art galleries. Not the art world. So, and you know, the art world expanded itself, tetrad itself. So by 2000, major art critics are quitting the art world because it's meaningless. There's so much art and variety. There's no schools dominating. Just whatever you got, let's see if you can sell it. Go to Venice Biennale. Go to that Biennale. Do this. And they're hiring and making famous grad students. So the art world is McDonald's burgers by 2000. And Jerry Saltz and these guys are quitting. I buy their books and get their collected essays as they go through this identity crisis of being an art critic, because finally the art world became non-art, which it always was compared to McLuhan's definition of art.
Well, I mean, what comes to mind is when McLuhan is talking about the total environment as art.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like painting and music and cinema were constitutive arts 100 years ago, 100 plus years ago, but with, let's say, modernism as a whole, with nationalism as a mixed corporate media, where the Soviets decide, we're going to make all of culture, and your total environment is now going to be Soviet culture, and the Nazis are like, we're going to make German culture, and your entire life is going to be our piece of art now. Ever since then, like, the total environment is an art, right?
And these are in Lewis's books, Tar, The Art of Being Ruled. That's all what he's dealing with. He's seeing this pattern. Tar is artists from five different countries battling. And people look back and says he predicted the structure of World War One. But he put it into personal art world terms, right? Little chemical bodies. A German against a Russian against a French and an English guy. That's Tar, 1918, I think. Critics recognize it now as anticipating, because it was a setting before World War One. But it predicted the clash of cultures, what you just said. Any more you want to say about that?
Yeah, what's that anime where all the different Hetalia, Axis Powers. So William Lewis predicted Hetalia.
What's that? The Axis Powers?
I'm only being one quarter facetious.
Well, you know, you got the Allies versus the Axis. You got Germans, Japanese, and Italians against French, English, and eventually Canada and Americans.
Yeah, the series' main presentation is as a comedic allegory of political and historical events, as well as more general cultural comparisons. Characters...
Wait, oh, are you reading a summary of Tar?
No, I'm reading a summary of Italia, the anime. Characters
anime?
Characters are personifications of countries, regions such as Hong Kong, and micronations. Both positive and negative cultural stereotypes form a part of each character's personality.
Okay, so anime did this, well, when was that? In the 90s or something?
2006 to 2013.
Okay, that's the famous anime, Italia?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, well, no, it's good to bring it. Okay, there is the android meme replaying back when they were humans, Tar.
There you go.
You know, and but it's, you know, got more special effects and mixed corporate media in it.
Of course.
So we got onto that because we were talking about the magazine as the art gallery's magazines. The obsolescence of Gutenberg Arts. It blew itself up, made, you know, billionaires, bought all this stuff, and makes art, you know, a painting sells for $100 million now, right? It got absorbed into commerce. If you want to say, I'm not in business, I'm not in commerce, that's assholes, I'm a communist, I'm a Luddite, I'm a Nazi, we're going feudal, we're going to get rid of this capitalism and come up with an anti-environment. That old moralism or humanism or having a conscience, which art tried to be, that's the guy, John Vos Dossos guy in Interior Landscape, right? The Syndrome of John Dossos?
He does the three books on New York, right?
Yeah, redoing Ulysses and Joyce, but from a Marxist or socialist point of view of issues and social justice stuff, which McLuhan always mocked. And he would claim that Joyce was doing that. He made Joyce like himself. So the modern or pre-woke social justice hero is the Gutenberg artist that are getting these grants in Toronto. Got to look up what's her name's name, Marsha somebody, who started A-Space. But she, I don't know if I finished that. So she finally posted on Fake Explorations a question, a thoughtful thing directed at any of us. Nobody responded. I think she was grossly insulted, realized we were a bunch of jokers and weren't serious and too busy masturbating our own stuff. We didn't give a fuck about what she was learning and taking seriously, and she disappeared. She never posted again. So I monitored her on her Facebook page. I became an acquaintance of hers through Facebook. You look, go to her Facebook page, she doesn't fucking post at all. I don't know what's happened to her. She's a massive identity crisis or something. She was very active on her Facebook page right when we were, and she was on our page and all that, but she dropped off. So I'll have to look up her name, before we end the recording of this. But the I thought that was interesting that someone who took it might have thought we were just a bunch of guys. She was one of the rare women on there, and we weren't going to talk to a woman. You know, who knows what baby boomer projection she put into there. But I think I should have said something. I didn't. But I used to go over to her Facebook page and post my choice cuts on her page. But she would post them but never react to them. Because I didn't react to her thing or something. And there's another one on Fake Exploration. She's Jewish. She lives in England, but I think she grew up in Israel. She's a friend of Adam Pugender. I got to look up these two names. So anyways, you got this 1965. So from 87 to 91 is an interesting thing worth reading of how he's trying to AP, anthropomorphic physical, the artist, and think that's what McLuhan meant by Canada as an anti-environment, or as an artist. So I have here on page 91, let's see, we did 87-91, I did the quote from 87, now 91, he says, now he talks about in 66, McLuhan writes a good little article for some artist magazine called Technology and Environment, maybe, or Technology and Culture. I don't know if it's the same thing. There's this thing I have it, Technology and Culture, but maybe it's Technology and Environment. So McLuhan's argument in this thing called Technology and Environment extends his earlier and frequently cited aphoristic reading from Understanding Media in 1964 of, quote, art at its most significant as a dew line, a distant early warning system that can always be relied on to tell the old culture what is beginning to happen to it. End of quote. Indeed, so he's putting together the artist and the counter environment becomes the dew line, but it's a cultural dew line. So that's a nice use of the military dew line. Indeed, he says, Mr. Welch, here we find a similarly crossed analogy of the military-industrial complex with the visual arts as encountered in the Marfleet lecture. If artists are prophetic and their work visionary, for McLuhan, this was also Canada's role in the post-war global landscape. So I read that again. Indeed, here we find a similarly crossed analogy, I guess talking about dew line as analogy, distant early warning system, military thing as an analogy of culture, an analogy of the military-industrial complex with the visual arts, so that the visual arts are, that's cultural Gutenberg arts are like the military dew line. Gutenberg artists are prophetic as laid out in the Marfleet lecture. And then he says, if artists, Gutenberg artists are prophetic and their work visionary, for McLuhan, this was also Canada's role in the post-war global landscape. Was Canada visionary or prophetic? Not really. It was.
We had a lot of great comedians get famous in the States.
No, that's a good point that this sense of humor came out of Canada. You know, it was remarked on in the 80s that how come all these top comedians, Saturday Night Live, the kid who got sick, are Canadians? What's coming out of Canada? I remember some Canadian critic saying, McLuhan is a lot funnier than Dan Aykroyd. Interesting statement. And that's, long after McLuhan's day. Maybe it's a Canadian doesn't like this defector, this Canadian Aykroyd, whose parents knew McLuhan, were friends, defects and ends up in The Beast in New York on Saturday Night Live. Now, what's interesting, people use, McLuhanites talk about the military-industrial complex. They never read the sentence in Take Today, that's a rearview mirror image. McLuhan says the popularity of the phrase military-industrial complex is an example of it's obsolete. It's not what's happening. Military-industrial complex is not what's in charge. What's in charge is the prince of the air on the software level of the word that makes a market in the White House, and maybe on the advertising level in New York is the other part of the cultural warfare that the prince of the air is doing.
All right,
on the software level.
I am going to make a short discursion into video. very short, mind you. Just
you're going to show us something, you mean?
Yes, I'm going to show you something.
Okay.
All right, here it is, and I need to send you the audio.
A good Andy environment to my voice.
Yes, yes, precisely.
I'm not trying to dominate things. I'm just saying here's an important new point, which you guys are all appreciating. You're all learning something here about this amazing statement by McLuhan that Canada is the environment.
The drink the astronauts took to the moon.
Astronauts to the moon.
The drink the astronauts took to the moon.
Astronauts to the moon.
The pro shop called. Your new putter has arrived.
Yeah.
The Apollo mission put on the world with a big introduction and.
Now, that's a good example. That's a great. The moon. Okay, Brian.
Apollo program, McLuhan had called that happen.
You're blipping out too much, Brian. Don't talk.
Well, can I just also say that this is the clip that my friend brought up out of the blue an hour ago, and also it featured Dan Aykroyd. So,
is that Dan Aykroyd laughing or something?
Yeah. Well,
now, here's what's amazing. McLuhan always mocked the space program. And you know what he said, Brian, about it? What was wrong about it? Is that they were doing the Columbus.
It was Newtonian.
Columbus. It was sending people out there to be killed or to stir up cultures, whereas what should happen, you send out no people. You send out rockets to go out there and probe around and do the work of exploring. We don't need to go out there in this horrible environment of a rocket ship. You're like the poor guys on the Columbus ships, all starving to death, you know. That's the point. What'd you say?
I said they had Tang.
No, they did. They had no fucking Tang. You fucking nut. They had fucking marijuana, Clinton.
But no, I mean, and McLuhan did say, he also said, McLuhan said about NASA that stuff they put out is cheap science fiction.
Yeah, 19th century.
One of my favorite quotes. But this one that Cameron found in the Esquire is incredible. I mean, maybe it's my bias, but to me, it's very clear why McLuhan would choose that one great quote about the oddest thing that was ever found.
Yeah.
To me, that just translates as, this is the biggest, worst shit that ever been on a global audience.
Yeah, McLuhan anticipated all the conspiracy content of the internet days, like the fake moon landing. He fucking did it. By his abstractions, his poetic statements included the fake. He said, so it's a bigger fake than they faked the moon landing, but it's even bigger than that. It's a replaying Finnegan's Wake, you know what I mean? And the thickest dump is turning the earth ball into an art form, and you get ecology, right? That's another part of the meaning there. Now that cartoon you just played is a great capsulization of McLuhan's attitude. That's them. That's Dan Aykroyd imitating McLuhan. Because that's what McLuhan did. He was sneering. And so when he gets on there, they put him on. Reality knows where the action is. And it knows what to produce. So NASA knew to put McLuhan on the day they landed on the moon, which was McLuhan's fucking birthday. And I think McLuhan talks about it being his birthday. He turns it into him. He makes him the, it's all about me. He does that right there on NASA. He's,
he did mention that. And don't forget, they also ended their shuttle missions, their decades of space shuttles. The very last shuttle mission landed and concluded on 100.
Is that right? When was that? 2011, that was the last shuttle or something?
Yeah, 2011.
And it landed on his, and they did it on his
last
birthday?
Shuttle mission land.
There's reality running its own art form.
That's why Canadian.
What?
Also why even Canadian news organizations didn't mention Centennial. They were too busy reporting on the end of the shuttle program. So it was sort of, it was almost a way of at McLuhan. He didn't get any publicity on his 100th birthday.
Now, but you know what it was? This is very important, this moon landing. I'm glad you brought it up. And I didn't know about the second. That's cosmic coincidence, you know. Playing synchronicity on the God's view, God's bird's eye view, you know, where you're saying, well, he started it and he's there at the last. Because, you know, McLuhan, he's the guest. He's a Canadian. He's the Canadian nation as art form, as counter environment. And reality knows to put McLuhan on there as the critic to talk about. You know what I mean? Just when on the bicentennial, I was up in the World Trade Center, you know, the thing that got bombed in 9/11, on July 4th, 1976. When did that centennial happen? Yeah, 76. They've got audio and going on. People are up there at the top floors looking out over New York City, and the soundtrack is television stations broadcasting about the sailing ships, the sailing ships going up the Hudson. They have a name. A friend of mine was on them. And I'm up there, and all of a sudden I hear McLuhan's voice, and he says... They ask him, well, what do you say? What do you say for the next 100 years? And as McLuhan liked to say, he always go, in one word, he always liked to reduce things to one word or one phrase. The guy says, what's going to happen to America in the next 100 years, next bicentennial or whatever? He goes, well, in one word, apocalypse. And I hear this. And the guy goes, what? And I don't know what McLuhan says after that. It's not important. The point is, he said it's an apocalypse. So when I wrote a little article on 9/11, I pointed out that 25 years later, I was there in 76, and I witnessed the apocalypse, 9/11, 25 years later, that McLuhan predicted. And he predicted it where the McLuhan archivist was standing in the building that would be the apocalypse. See, so I put my, now I'm starting to put myself in there as orchestrating this thing, right? I'm the new Pharaonic McLuhan, and so I put myself in the history. But it's only I, nobody else wandering around, lots of people, tourists wandering around, nobody stopped to hear this guy say this. I only heard it because I recognized his voice and said, what, that's McLuhan talking, or maybe they said his name. So I made sure to hear it. And I heard the most important thing said on the centennial day for what was going to happen to America in the next 100 years, was it was going to go through apocalypse. And McLuhan called it. Well, that's anti-environment. Canada is anti-environment. And he did that in 69 for the moonshot. So why does reality, who is the smart guy, that or woman or dog, that puts the fucking right guy on there to comment on things where it resonates with other cultural history that no one knows about yet, right? Nobody knows who this McLuhan guy is on 69 and what he said about moonshots. He's actually the enemy. He's telling them, he didn't say it was obsolete when he was on there, right, on his birthday. I don't think he said that. I don't know all, I think I heard the tape once, but he was polite. He'd already put it down. It was talked, written in the book in 68, War and Peace and Gold Village. He talks about the Newtonian obsolete program at NASA. But This is who he's up against. Who is he up against, Brian? He is up against NASA, the fucking Nazi network, Project Paperclip. They're the artists, the fucking, and they're the ones putting on the fake moon landing. And they're Nazis. They don't have a care about America's cultural pride in being the first on the moon. They've got a bigger agenda. They want to keep their empire going on the secret level. So the Project Paperclip, the Nazis, Wernher von Braun and those guys doing this moon landing are the hidden ground of the real intelligence and the real CIA that I say McLuhan is the head of. So probably Wernher Braun, devout McLuhanite, said, we're going to have McLuhan on here. We know what he says about us, and we're going to nail him. We're going to put him here and put him in the hot seat. There's a whole story there. You can make a movie out of this, for fuck's sake, what I'm saying. Another amazing broadcast by Bob about this issue in my little segment here. I will soon retreat from this segment, and other people can take over. But this moon thing, and then you have my assistants here making these little anime quotes, which are totally appropriate. Play it again, Clinton. What if somebody says something and then the guy laughs?
Okay.
Moon landing. Just goes moon landing.
Okay, here we go.
Tang, the drink the astronauts took to the moon.
Astronauts to the moon.
The pro shop called. Your new putter has arrived.
That's Wernher von Braun. Remember, you know, how many Nazis have to survive to win the war? If you're in charge of the new environment, which is the global theater and the satellite environment, and you're Nazis, aren't you kind of in the victory seat? You're running the hidden ground, the real new power. The fucking, you know, the Nazis won World War II, but they only needed 5 or 30, how many of the Project Paperclip guys they had, there's different numbers, 178 of them, that's enough from Germany. They just needed that. Yeah, the rest of the people are just somnambulists, fake citizens. It's a battle, you know, TAR is a battle, Clinton, like Italia, between different intelligence groups. I always say the center of the Android meme is the historical Jesuits, the Freemasons in Britain, Jesuits in the Vatican, the German Nazis, the Russian Bolsheviks, and the Israeli Mossad. Those are the five parts of the intelligence world, the five representatives for the human level as they build the tech body, which won't need humans. I've never seen the Black Sparrow cover of TAR before, Clinton. That's interesting. Nice cover. Never saw that before. I've got the hardback, you know, the original stuff. You know, Black Sparrow did good stuff. Brian, did we do something there? I stopped reading. Oh, yeah, we did the moon landing. Okay. Let me just finish the final quotes here. We did. So note, the McLuhanite, he's writing an article, McLuhan. He doesn't know that you shouldn't use the phrase military-industrial complex. Nobody knows. What is the term if you're not going to use military-industrial complex? You've seen since then. People say military-industrial entertainment complex, military-industrial Hollywood complex, military-industrial media complex. That came out of the last few years, Brian, right? COVID. That's a COVID effect. Or the Me Too effect. The Trump effect is the military, the people became aware of the military-industrial media or information world. A little late, but you know what I mean? People are trying to do what McLuhan demanded in 1972. Dump that you can't limit it to military-industrial. Get the importance of that, Brian?
I sadly missed only just the last 30 seconds.
The.
Heard before, but I don't know the last 30 seconds.
What do you think you heard me say? Do you remember any words from it?
She's wondering about the term military-industrial complex.
Oh, yeah, the military-industrial complex. What happened last, you know, since Trump, People now call it the military-industrial entertainment complex or the military-industrial media complex. They don't limit it to military-industrial complex. Just the old SDS boomers and anti-Trump leftist journalists do military-industrial complex. That's an old category. And McLuhan in 72 said, that ain't work. That's not it. That's not what you got to say it is. He didn't suggest anything new. But we now do have the population has awoke, is caught up to Finnegan's Wake, to quote the March 1970 letter to Playboy. You know, Eliot's auditory imagination was normal awareness in 70, but Finnegan's Wake was not. We have arrived at Finnegan's Wake as normal awareness now, just by the multiplicity of media and people not able to live with it all and different reactions to that. Did you say agreed? Yeah. And so they'll say military-industrial media, military-industrial. You could say that is an effect of Trump. He brought in the media part of power.
Right.
And that makes him an artist. As I say, I say in that article. Like, what are you saying? You're blipping out. Les Clinton caught it.
Military-industrial eloquence.
Yeah, eloquence. No, I didn't make it. Yeah, that's dealing with AI. Just dealing with the old clunky thing, military-industrial complex. I say in my essay on Trump, my first little preliminary essay before the main one, that he was the greatest artist of the time in 2016. That's a tough one for people to take, but it's true. And I just realized now, he caused the word to change. He updated the military-industrial cliche. And he's doing Finnegan's Wake. He's Squadron Phoenix. He's all over the place as president. He's doing Finnegan's Wake. So more credit to Bob. I called all this. I'm the prophet. I said it. And you know, through the years.
Praise
so
Bob.
We go, yeah, praise Bob. So we go to page 98.
Okay, hold on. Give me a second. Okay.
Are you showing us something here?
Dude, we've been reading along with you this entire time.
Wow. You got the whole book there?
Yes.
Oh, man, amazing. Yeah, I'll keep reading by my book. That's too small. So the 98, back to the military-industrial. He calls it a similarly crossed analogy. Now, he's talking about dew line, right? Military dew line is a cultural dew line, McLuhan says Canada is. He's calling it a similarly crossed analogy on page 91. Then he repeats it by saying in 98, in the middle, sort of, as with McLuhan's cross analogy. What is this fucking phrase, cross analogy?
Anyway, Star-crossed lovers, Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, you've never heard cross analogy as a phrase, right?
But I think he means it something like mixed metaphor, only
yeah.
with more like a triangulation than a bad grammar, you know?
Okay. As with McLuhan's crossed analogy of artist as maker of counter-environments and Canada as an artist figure, the dew line. So he's calling the dew line as a crossed analogy. The dew line also, or two, would apply both to art and Canada through McLuhan's writing in the 1960s. So he's got these two factors, artists as counter-environments and Canada's counter-environments. They merge with the phrase dew line. As with McLuhan's cross analogy of artist as maker of counter-environments and Canada as an artist figure, the dew line, too, would apply both to art and Canada through McLuhan's writing in the 1960s. So the dew line, not only the military, but it's the military-industrial software complex. And he's calling it art and Canton and getting it mixed up because he's thinking of Gutenberg arts. Then it says McLuhan and Bruce Powers. Bruce Powers, ex-CIA, did a book with McLuhan. McLuhan and Bruce Powers revisited these associations in a chapter, maybe, The United States and Canada, The Border as a Resonating Interval, arguing that the dew line points up a major Canadian role in the 20th century, the role of hidden ground for big powers. That's him as the hidden CIA. that phrase, the role of hidden ground for big powers for the United States. Canada is the hidden ground. Marsha was the hidden ground of the CIA, Brian. That's, remember I said, wow, I found something to support what I said. That's the sentence. Then he continues, since the McClune empowers them. That's a good phrase there. Sit for me. Since the United States has become a world environment, said McClune and Powers, so they're repeating what they said at the Marfleet lecture, Canada has become, well, it was becoming one, so now in 20 years later, the United States has become a world environment. Canada has become the anti-environment that renders the United States more acceptable and intelligible to many small countries of the world. Anti-environments are indispensable for making an environment understandable. See, now that's changed. It's flipped into the opposite. Justin Trudeau was murdered. He's considered the biggest asshole. You know, Tucker Carlson has made it a personal campaign to get rid of Justin Trudeau. Canada does not work. Now, what's interesting, Tucker says Canada used to be a nice place, a wonderful place, and something happened to it. Well, the tech body happened to it. It's beyond human management now. So Canada was the last art form, the last anti-environment, you could say, on the short list of it. So you have McLuhan being the hidden ground. They don't put Andy Warhol up there. They don't put John Cage up there. Now, what's Warhol and these artists who make it, sell paintings, keep painting, got to do painting, put on a magazine, and have to socialize every fucking night? And I don't know if I read it somewhere or I intuited this. Warhol kind of disliked the social life he had to leave, but he had to live, but he had to be mingling all the time to make connections, to get new paintings, to stay alive in New York, which was getting more and more expensive due to the hidden ground of computer speed up of the economy. So this great artist is not a great artist. He's a puppet in the art industry, and the great artist is someone who's not commercial at all, who's just sort of talking for free, is the guy they put on the major, as McClune said, the moon landing was the greatest teaching machine that ever happened, the greatest classroom event. He said that about the moon landing. So this goes back to them guys saying here, when Betts saying that McClune saw the classroom as a revolutionary medium. Yeah, he certainly did. He made the world his classroom. So that was page 98. Over on page 99, if you want to go over there, Clinton, the last four lines, it's talking about some artists doing stuff against another artist, a guy named Vizan. And I underlined this sentence. So they're trying to exchange information, these artists. It's like mail art in the early 70s. This artist-centered exchange network served as an early warning system of another kind, : heralding a radically altered means of communicating only fully realized with the advent of the internet decades later. So Mr. Welch is saying that a bunch of obscure Canadian artists were prophets the way they think McLuhan means it, and they predicted the internet the way they exchanged their art installations with each other. All right? That's why I underlined it. More arrogance there.
Yeah, extreme arrogance. Yeah, yeah. Hey, these guys did things across the world. And you know what else goes across the world? The internet.
Right. So, now, the whole dialogic aspect. Even Tim Leary said, well, McLuhan didn't know that the internet allows us to dialogue with each other. It's two-way, not just one-way. Broadcast media, analogy media was one-way. They don't know, the McLuhan said, the dialoguing was part of the participatory effect of tactile media because the senses engaged dialogue with each other and were altered. They don't know that participational dialogue nature of cool media. They don't know that. So they miss in their speculations. Okay, so that was 99, and then we go over to 103. And I got a good section here. Most of the page underlined Clinton. If you want to go to 103.
I'm with
you, Bob. You're there. Okay. Don't know what I said here, but let's go. On newsstands, in mailbags, and on gallery walls across Canada, artists, no, dupes of grant grubbing, took up the border as method and subject, engaging with contemporary debates around transnationalism. You know, McLuhan's Global Village, which has now become a global theater. They're not into that. They're into the Global Village dialogue. They were not only thinking of centers and peripheries, but especially following centennial celebrations, addressing questions of cultural nationalism and American imperialism in their work. Oh, wow. They're becoming woke, becoming communists, Marxists, critics of 19th century issues about nations. Like, this is bad art criticism. This is whatever people read as art criticism in October magazine missed out on the Clement Greenberg-McLuhan debate done secretly by McLuhan. That was the real art criticism. And these interviews, like when he goes to the Ottawa, I posted many years ago, he goes to Ottawa in summer of 1970, and he's on a panel with Harold Rosenberg and all these major artists, and it's McLuhan's first time he speaks to the art world, the art industry gang at the National Archives in Ottawa. And man, does he talk and make an amazing speech. I should quote from some of it. He basically says, this is all a lot of nothing. You guys are not artists, is what he tells them. They can't believe it. And Rosenberg, I think it was him, some critic there is like shocked. I was a fan of McLuhan, but this is crazy what he's saying. We know that Rosenberg was at another panel with McLuhan down near New York State in 69, and McLuhan is talking cliched archetype, you know, from cliched archetype book stuff jargon before the book came out, I think. And Rosenberg, who was a big fan of McLuhan in 64, admits publicly that he had no clue what McLuhan was talking about in 69 because they did not read McLuhan from 64 to 69 and worked their way through the books. And eventually, even though this was before from cliched archetype, but if you were tuned in, you might anticipate, what's the name of the guy in San Francisco? Gossage. Gossage is the one. Yeah, you can read it in Hot and Cool, 1967, the four phases, where an art form is the last word, then it's a cliche, then it's an art form, then it's an archetype. Goes from cliche to archetype. Gossage laid out that in his little contribution to that book of critical articles on McLuhan by Gerald Stern. So if you're really concerned, of course, Rosenberg couldn't be concerned. He had his own career in New York to be busy and parties to go to and hang out with Andy Warhol, which McLuhan, when he met Warhol, he said to Carpenter, what a rube. You know that story? He insulted. He walked into a... What'd you say, Clinton?
Tell us the story.
This is why you have to read Carpenter's essay at the back of Thiel's book. He talks about it.
Yeah, that not Carpenter, see.
Yeah, so Carpenter talks about he McLuhan was in New York. He wanted McLuhan to meet Warhol because Carpenter was very involved with Warhol. He and his wife and his mother-in-law were promoting all this art bullshit, the Dia Foundation. And so he brought McLuhan to a party with Kurt Vonnegut and Andy Warhol as fellow dinner companions. McLuhan walks in, and Carpenter, who's the host, is shocked that McLuhan speaks without any attempt to not be heard. Carpenter says, that's Andy Warhol, and McLuhan goes, oh, that rube. This is a detached guy. He ain't trying to make it on the social network, right? He's a homeless. Homeless and environment. And then...
Hold on. Here we go. Hold on.
You going to bring up that book?
In 1970, I began teaching at the New York School for Social Research in New York over the next few years, Marshall and I met irregularly in Toronto and New York. The exuberant, witty rainmaker was now a wary, irritable jukebox reciting old phrases in random order. Sarcasm provided protection. One evening in New York, he arrived for dinner. When Kurt Vonnegut walked in, Marshall said, who's that? Vonnegut. Can't stand his work. That's an all-out voice. Then, who's that? Warhol. He even looks like a peasant.
And then it says, sittings were rearranged. That's fantastic. You can find these books. Why are these books available, Clinton?
Because I am a computer nerd, I guess.
Oh, like you have an archive of books? So
oh, God, yes. Of course I do. Don't you? Doesn't everyone here?
No, not online. I have a few, but not like this. And okay, so you didn't go any. You didn't Google this. You
no, it's
had
all on
these
the computer.
Books.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very good. And you had this book, the one I'm doing, Counterblasting Canada. Did you just grab that today or something?
Yeah. So yeah, I didn't have it yet, but it was available, so I snagged it. I got the PDF now. Yeah.
And so you knew about this book maybe before.
No. Well, maybe okay. A long time ago, I forgot about it.
Yeah.
The title rings a bell.
I think you'll enjoy reading it. It, you know, within the old Gutenberg world of arts, there's
yeah,
at least
yeah,
talk.
Everyone else trying to grapple with it, trying to judge. Like you said, it's valuable to compare how they read a quote and try to fit it into their understanding of the larger, they might say, context.
Right, and nobody in the Canadian art world is making an issue, which they should, out of Sheila, Wilford, and Marshall. I agree. The Canadian Vortices update, they're important in Canadian art history in the old Gutenberg Institute level. You know what I mean? They're important. And this book, these guys recognize that. So you're counterblasting Ken.
Bob, it's not a history. It's an arstery.
That's a new one. Instead of a herstory, it's an arstery. Yeah. Okay, so it's funny watching how this guy is talking. He's analyzing the artists of the day, and they're Canadians and proud of it and getting more and more tribal and pissed off at America and Canada's role in transnationalism. They were not only thinking, these artists, of centers and peripheries, but especially following centennial celebrations, addressing questions of cultural nationalism and American imperialism in their work. That these practices found parity in McLuhan's own theory of Canada as a borderline case is telling. What's parity mean? Just parallel? Found relevance? Can you look up parity, Clinton? They talk about parity in the news all the time about union negotiations, right? They achieve parity. It should be parity. Yeah. What do you get, Clinton, when you do parody?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's a mathematical sense as well, but, yeah, parody means equality, basically.
Okay, or matching, yeah.
Yeah. Brian's
okay, that these, yeah, that these practices match McLuhan's own theory of Canada as a borderline case is telling. Now, how did these match? Well, they don't fucking match, right? But their little minds, Gutenberg minds, they think it's matching McLuhan's theory of Canada. Well, as a borderline, okay, these guys did art on the border, or about the border, so that's literal. Oh, that's like McLuhan's borderline case. It's rather, that's matching. That's visual bias, unaware. That these practices found matching in McLuhan's own theory of Canada as a borderline case is telling. Any environment, McLuhan suggests in the Marfleet lecture, tends to be imperceptible to its users and occupants, except to the degree that counter-environments are created by the artist. So any environment tends to be imperceptible, and you can only get it through the artist who creates a counter-environment. McLuhan's reading of the country as an artist figure in his lecture and elsewhere in his writing resonates strongly with the interaction and occasional interrogation of the United States carried out by artists in Canada during the period. No, it's like you said, Clinton, they were mailing art to each other and dialoguing through visual media. Oh, that's like the internet.
Yeah.
They're doing the same thing here. A bunch of guys creating an art installation. Remember, art's anything you can get away with, and they get some attention in Canada's art world for doing stuff on the border. That is like McLuhan borderline, Canada borderline case. That's silly. Anyways, you know what I mean? They're matching. That these guys. What?
Well, yes, of course it's silly. But also, think about it. This guy, I presume, is an expert in Canadian art.
Yeah.
He's an authority. He's writing about McLuhan in relation to Canadian art. He's employed at a university. This is a field people are interested in. This is very valuable stuff if you value universities. The problem is that universities are not anti-environments.
Yeah. Like, yeah, no, there's a lot of contradictions and compromise and hypocrisy in it all. But I don't fight it. I read the book. I read their stuff, and I learn about these artists.
I'm trying to place myself in the feet of some skeptical new listener who's listening to us laugh at this essay. I'm like, all right, this guy actually did research. He studied Canadian art. What more do you want? McLuhan's talking about Canadian artists. He's talking about art. You know, like, he's saying Canada is... He's saying at the large scale that Canada is the anti-environment. He's saying at the small scale the artist creates anti-environments. Here are anti-environment creators in the biggest anti-environment in the world. Why are they not doing the thing McLuhan says that the anti-environments are doing? Like, what the fuck's wrong with you, Bob? You know?
I know. Fully aware of that, and I absorb all objections. I'm on their side. It's like the old thing about McLuhan. He's talking about books being obsolete, but he spends all his fucking life reading books. And he's the biggest book reader of anybody for an obsolete meaning. But you have to understand what obsolescence. McLuhan didn't mean you ignore what's obsolete. Obsolescence means it becomes prominent, becomes figure. And everybody's doing it. But it's not constitutive. Constitutive is Project Paperclip, 178 fucking Nazis, running the intelligence services of the United States on the way to the moon. And then you bring in Kubrick. I met a guy who was a fantastic fanatic about Kubrick, and he said, Kubrick was a great artist. What an incredible artist. And I said, no, he's nothing compared to McLuhan. And he said, what are you talking about? He's way better than McLuhan. And so I told him, well, you know what McLuhan said about your big movie, 2001? No, what did he say? It's totally 19th century Newtonian. It's obsolete. It's ridiculous. He goes, what? That's bullshit. Fuck that. Space is the future. Blah, blah, blah. You know? So it's interesting how McLuhan was an anti-environment to Kubrick. You know, in the film world, I enjoyed Kubrick's movies. I would say he was a great filmmaker, but that's in the puny little world of the many worlds I live in and you live in. Right?
So would you say that your quadrants basically make you at all times three-quarters anti-environments, but one-quarter relatable?
Oh, yeah. I'm always relatable. Why the fuck are we doing this? Why do I say Greg is the most important person on the panel? I made that public. So Mary McLuhan said her father always told her, you got a problem with somebody? Got a grievance? Never confront them with it. Go around them. And that's his personal advice on the chemical body family level, telling his daughter, don't confront people if you got a problem. Figure out how to accept them, work around them, and maybe some other stuff. Well, that's a local version of be an invisible environment. Your grievance is invisible. You don't let the person know you have a grievance against them. And you're the invisible environment in relation to that person. You're the new environment, and you don't let them know about it. And that's McLuhan's media principle made on the phylogenic species level versus
the individual.
So
that's McLuhan's principle, but it's certainly not your principle when you criticize, let's say, the MEA.
Oh, I'll be an asshole every now and then. Yeah. Every now and then you're allowed to have a tantrum. I'm not going around trying to be proper and perfect. I'm going to do it all. I'm pretty good at being perfect. I'm the perfect fucking citizen. I don't have a car. I don't pollute. I have no fucking print. I don't even know what it is. Eco print. But I'm the best.
Economy. I'm the perfect citizen. I don't volunteer. Oh, yeah. Bank.
Yeah, you mentioned economy. I do everything for free. But McLuhan did everything. He, to say that, what did he say? I just saw that a minute ago. His words, he was the greatest artist, but he did his art outside of the industry. They used him a little bit, just like they used Baudrillard 20 years later, replayed that. And McLuhan ignored it all. They used him, but they couldn't commercialize him. They couldn't make a big Andy Warhol of him, and they make lots of big gallery scenes and sell McLuhan books for $1 billion or something. He always was operating beyond the commercial realm and offered insights beyond that.
It's funny because books for business managers and people who graduate with like MBAs and whatnot are basically written for a 12th grade level. Yeah. And then you go and you read Take Today and you're like, what the fuck? You expect people who like barely read out of high school to be able to read this shit?
Yeah, remember they told him what he did on Saturday Media. You can't have more than 10% new stuff, Marshall. And Marshall's was 90% new stuff.
Yeah.
But you can't, you could say you can't stop the truth. People like to say the truth always comes out. The right artist, the perfect, the guy with the perfect pitch who is relevant, that must go into the world of culture, must be registered in the God's purpose of having culture and media, whatever it is, you couldn't stop McLuhan. They had all these rules about him. They put this stupid book out, and it became a hit, you know, because it was, there's a certain part of the people who become famous are predestined to become famous because they have an important point that later generations and humans are suffering life on this planet and being Christian sinners, they have culture to distract themselves. You've got to have high points in culture all through the past. You've got to keep adding new high points. So McLuhan had to be added to Picasso from the 20s. You know what I mean? So you couldn't stop him. That's what's interesting. You couldn't stop Zappa. And you can't stop me and what we're doing, what Iron's doing. So I'm one of the first people to talk about the artistic process and the process of, you know, you have perfect pitch. McLuhan talked about perfect pitch. The artist always said the fame, the real, the castle level of fame that couldn't be stopped. McLuhan called perfect pitch. The artist is perfect pitch for his time. You just need one guy who's reflecting the rhythms of the technology of the 20s. You can't, you don't have to have everybody. Even there were lots of artists who equal to Picasso and what they did and what they innovated. But there's always going to be the prince of the air, you could say, the devil is going to hoik up someone to keep the fame thing going, to keep achievement, the myth of achievement going. You know, McLuhan used to say in Take Today, success is failure and failure is success. Zappa said the same thing. Why are we talking about that?
Couldn't sell a book. Business management book. He couldn't write a business management book because he wrote over everyone who works in business's head.
Truth. So they say the truth will out. Yeah, in social media, what Ayn calls mortar, human communication, which goes on regardless. We come, live here, die, and mortar goes on. And people are creates like language. We create and add to it with new media, add to language. So that's our great artwork, the human artwork. One of the stories is that the truth will always come out. Well, perfect pitch is part of truth. When you say truth is coming out, people usually think of verbal statements or a fact about a crime or something. They don't think of cultural events as truth that can't be stopped. The perfect pitch always happens. That's what I was trying to say. A new meaning for truth, or it's encompassed later environments, not just verbal truth. Or accounting data and stolen funds kind of truth. That brings in Trump. He's new environment. The only, as May Brussels said, the only way you can stop the conspiracy is have a legal case. Books, reports, movies don't work. You've got to get these guys in court and have a real honest trial. Well, that's the only thing in our culture is take someone to court. We used to say on CKLN, I used to say, you're not an artist unless you're arrested. And when they tried to arrest McLuhan, the governor general did that, and they arrested LaRouche, and they harassed Zappa. And so I could say arrest is in my future.
They tried to
Again, you blipped out. You go, they tried to arrest, and then we don't know what your object is of your sentence. You got to say it again.
Who did they try to arrest, Bob? Who did you name?
Well, I want to hear what Brian. Is that what you're asking, Brian?
He's expressing surprise that someone you just claimed was nearly arrested. Who was it?
Yeah, McLuhan, I said. I think that's what surprised you. You know how that was done? The Governor General in 69, famous guy with a Vanier, he had a cool name, you know, like Saint Vanier, something like that. Yeah, I think it was him. He in Parliament or wherever he fucking was in his role as Governor General of Canada said, McLuhan, this is when they were worried about student riots and students burning down schools. And McLuhan was interviewed and he said, yeah, these students are going to burn down all the schools. Vanier took that personally. He says, we can't have this professor out there saying that we're going to be burning things down. He's encouraging the students to burn them. We need to do something about him. I don't know if he said jail. He might have. But he said, we need to discipline this fucker. Now he's wondering what McLuhan thought of that, you know. What do you think of that that charge? Because they give him the, again, you can't stop him. He gets the Order of Canada the next year in 1970. Right, well, when Vanier is having a heart attack about him.
This is the I pull a fire alarm and you call me an arson thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, the simple, in his letter about the Bilderbergers to another prince, Bernhard of the Netherlands, married to the queen. He says, I thought I'd meet sophisticated European guys in the Gutenberg world, Gutenberg sophisticates at this conference. I met nothing but dull 19th century numbskulls who had no clue about what was going on. That's what Vanier is. He's an elite Bilderberger guy with numbness. And you have to be numb to operate in the center of the, quote, Illuminati. You have to be indifferent to everything, all the shit you're creating. I guess like George Soros is. A lot of people blame him for all kinds of chaos and that. He has to be indifferent to it and be numb to it. He can't be human. Sounding too moral, right? Okay, so back to this page 103. You just what, Brian? Yeah, nothing. We did that. McLuhan's reading of the country as an artist figure in his lecture and elsewhere in his writing resonates strongly with the interaction and occasional interrogation of the United States carried out by artists in Canada during the period. Considering these varied projects in tandem with McLuhan's writing on Canadian-U.S. relations, we should be reminded of the continued role of artists in elaborating political realities. Now, see, McLuhan really nailed the political realities. The software tech body, head of the tech body, Word Makes a Market, the military-industrial media complex. And McLuhan was the only artist calling out the real politics. They used to say that McLuhan avoided politics. Yeah, he avoided 19th century politics, but these guys are still thinking in 19th century terms when they say political realities. We should be reminded of the continued role of artists in elaborating political realities. Counter-environments made by artists still serve to make perceptible the powerful American ground. Tactical media artists such as the Yes Men explicitly take to task right wing, see they put in their political bias, right wing, they take to task the left wing, right wing politicians and multinational corporations such as Halliburton. You know who the Yes Men are?
No, man.
They're the guys, yeah, they imitate, like, every now and then you find out, you know, George Soros fooled by two artists who pretended they were Prince Philip or something. And he thought he was talking to Prince Philip. That's the, look it up, Clinton, the Yes Men. They got a great gig going. They fooled many people. They're like that comedian guy, you know, Abby Dabby, who would pretend to be interviewing people and fool people. He was big 15 years ago. You know.
What did Abby Dabby do?
He would interview people and act stupid. And they thought he was being genuine. And he totally put on the famous person he did.
Well,
everybody knows him. He was the biggest artist ever 15 years ago for a minute. You know, is he Afghani, Lebanese or something? Arab? Forget what he is. Sacha Baron Cohen. Is that the name? Baron Cohen. He had another name. Ali G. Ali G. Yeah, that's that guy. He would fool people all the time, right? Well, the yes men, I don't know, they would do it on phone or something. They'd phone these people up and get through and interview, Mitt Romney and humiliate him because Mitt thought he was talking to Prince Philip or somebody that they pretended they were. If you look up the Yes Men, I think that's, I'm thinking of the guys that do that. I think that's who they are, the Yes Men. Anybody Googling it? Get a few sentences on them?
All right, it's my job, isn't it?
Yeah, you're fast at it.
Yeah, and I'm showing you all what the fuck I'm doing, too, so. A culture-jamming activist duo, Jacques Servan and Igor Vamus. Vamos.
Yeah, and who do they interview? Do they list all the people they duped?
Yeah, probably.
Projects.
Posed as spokespeople for the World Trade Organization, McDonald's, Dow Chemical, blah, 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 blah. They inserted men kissing each other into SimCopter? How?
I don't know.
It's not even an online game. It's like you just play in your own SimCity 2000 maps. That's weird. There you go. Projects. George W. Bush. Oh, they made a fake campaign website for George W. Bush. Okay. They posed on... Okay, so they pretended to be from Dow Chemicals on the 20th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster, appearing on BBC World News or something. Okay.
There may be another duo that does this, and I'm mixing it up, but they're doing what I'm talking about.
Well, there's these Russian dudes who get phone calls.
Yeah, who are the Russian guys?
The Da-men. Da.
Wait, are you talking about the Yes Men with Russians or this other group I'm thinking of?
No, I'm just saying Da as yes. Because they're Russian. Never mind.
But you don't have the name of the other guys.
No, of course not.
Yeah. Anyways, we know what the Yes Men are. They're simulators. They're fakers. So this guy is a critic, Adam Welch, is praising the tactical media artists as the Yes Men explicitly take to task right-wing politicians and multinational corporations such as Halliburton. As pranksters, talking about the Yes Men, as pranksters who adopt corporate and political identities, they make declarations that their adopted hosts would never imagine. What they call, quote, identity correction. Just as the strategies have changed, so too have the subjects. Many artists aware of the ends to which nationalism has been used in recent decades seem less intent in interrogating the nation than on working outside its reach. That the moment described above is now past makes it no less compelling. Colon. Artists and their counter-environments are still much needed and sometimes show surprising power in keeping governments and corporations to account. It's well beyond that now, but yeah, back in 2015 or pre-Trump, you would think artists are doing something. You could say these kind of anti-environmental Gutenberg artists, they show up once a week all over the place. There's been hundreds of them for the last 10 years, right? They come in and they make a little scene and everybody says, well, that's pretty neat, and then it's gone. But then it's replaced by another media prank. Now, the media, the newspaper editors are doing that. They got to keep interest in their papers, so they got to make little pranks every now and then to show human chemical body ingenuity and keep people hopeful that there's room for the chemical body still. That's becoming fleeting, fleeting, fleeting. So this, what I just read, I underlined. Yeah.
You're eventually, the more success you have, the less you're able to get away with it. So it's not sustainable.
But you know what is sustainable? Until recently, is the newspaper. You keep the newspaper form going. So you change the content, you play games with it to get attention if your subscriptions are going down. But the audience's need to see themselves in the newspaper medium is very powerful, and that is the attention getter. That's the art form. It's the form of the newspaper that remains. You don't get rid of media, electric telegraph press. You don't get rid of television. And that's what's eroding or doing stuff and correcting everybody's identity. So you don't need artists in anti-environments. They don't work anymore. You know, Ted Carpenter wrote in They Became What They Beheld around 1970 that the New York Times became a counter-environment because the White House moved from confidentiality of the New York Times to Walter Cronkite and CBS and the TV networks. They obsolesced the New York Times, Washington Post, and the newspapers, and so that's why the newspapers went after Watergate and created Watergate, or went along with the stuff that Rockefeller was doing against Nixon, but they put it into the bottom-up world. And as McLuhan said later, Watergate was the battle between newspapers and television over the advertising dollar. That's all it was. And all this stuff is true because you don't stop the plague of media exaggeration, media excessiveness. Doesn't get stopped. And that's the real plague, the real horseman of the apocalypse. You know, the old famine, warfare, plague, these pop up all the time in the world. Little short bursts, right? A little war, a little plague, a little this, a little that, a little disaster. But the big disaster is the fact that Clinton is unemployed because the computerized media obsolesced the human. And so is Brian and Greg. You have to do a Herculean act like I did, evoking non-physical, to make a new environment that makes you employable or relevant. And then on the medicine level, too. So
it's funny because I'm employed and you're not, but it's still...
I'm employed, Clinton. I'm employed in maintaining pharaonic objectivity and superiority. We must give humans hope. There has to be a great artist every era. I'm the new great artist that eventually will be acknowledged. And you also have to be peripheralized and marginalized and not noticed while you're alive. Well, since I'm going to live for fucking 1,000 years, that ain't going to be that's going to be difficult to do, to isolate me. So perfect pitch. I'm going to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Clinton. It's unstoppable. What would it be? The Tech Body Hall of Fame. Are you falling asleep, Clinton? Are you tired?
You see, it's funny because museums and halls of fame tend to have visitors, and I'm not sure who the hell's visiting you there.
You guys are.
I don't need to go fucking go see.
Oh, what? Would visit me where? Where would you visit me?
Well, yeah, you're going to be in the Tech Body Hall of Fame. Is that what you said?
Yeah, that's just what we see right now in the world. The Tech Body is the museum we live in.
Rom from Simon & Schuster Interactive.
No, the Tech Body is the media, is the news of the day. That's the Tech Body.
Okay.
And there's all kinds of people enshrined in that. Oh, I don't know if I finished my thought. So since the law courts are pretty obsolete to catch a new artist, a new figure, they've had to throw 91 fucking cases against the new Tech Body, Mr. Trump. That shows you the old thing. You put the guy away, and McLuhan said in Russia, in the Soviet Union, they send you to Siberia. In North America or the West, they just ignore you. So they're trying to ignore Trump. That didn't work. So they're trying to send him to Siberia. The modern version would be jail. But they can't stop him, really. So they got to make up a lot of fake charges and piss off everybody. And that keeps the media noise going about discussing what shocking campaigns and trials these are. But the point is they had to do so many to stop this blob known as Trump. And that you're deliberating right today. Right now, the jury's deliberating. What are they going to do with him? Now, as many people have said, he's going to jail. The fucking thing is all faked. And the judge has already decided, paid off to do this and get his rewards. They ain't going to fucking let Trump off. They need a, they don't care whether he's guilty and the appeals next year gets him off. They just want to get him off the campaign trail, and they're hoping the public will be naive and say, this is a, oh, we didn't know Trump was a criminal. He's guilty in our sacred courts, so we won't vote for him. They're hoping for that, but there's a big school of thought, as the Bronx Democrat rallies show, that it ain't going to work. You're guaranteeing Trump will be president if you put him in jail.
Are they installing bars in the Oval Cell right now?
Yeah, they're doing all kinds of tricky. A lot of tricks are being developed in case, you know, the Nazis, they do the Project Paperclip. They don't just count on one method, Clinton. They got it all. They got so many alternative scenarios. They're ready for Trump to get victory via jail. They got counter environments for that, too. So, defrosting Canadian culture. I don't think I've ever seen that article, Clinton. I don't know if I have a copy of it, so that's fun. But what is it we were doing here? So I finished the book, right?
Yeah, and you finished the two articles you wanted to read about different takes on McLuhan and art history, I think.
Yeah, and showing the inadequacies of it. No, geez, man, it might have been like for 3 hours I talked. You see, I make an item to put on Ian and Bob. It's too long for people to listen to. But someday, when I'm in the Tech Body Hall of Fame, they'll listen to this and say, wow, Mr. Betts and Mr. Welch, Adam Welch, are going to be stunned. Wow, this guy really knows the stuff, and he really picked out some important points that we missed. Well, we were just doing our jobs. We had a wife and kids and mortgage. I had to fucking work in the art industry. There's no other jobs. Yeah, the homeless people are the real heroes. They dare to quit. Fuck you. I'm not participating in your evil machine. I'm going to walk around on the street. And they didn't know that they'd get a little dominant in the culture, you know, last few years. They didn't know that success would happen. But that's part of following the truth. Follow your truth. You don't want to work in the shit world, any job, drop out, become homeless. And then they become celebrities, for fuck's sake. And you can't arrest them or do anything to them. Another flip point there, Brian. Endless flip points.